I'm used to the idea of dying, but I have no desire to die for the likes of you.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
Startling new numbers out on a growing terrorist watch list in the U.S. USA Today reporting the list now has 1 million entries. That's up 32% since 2007.
This week in radical history for the week starting March 16th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Check this out, man. There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for March 16th, 1811, the Luddites attack machines designed to replace them. The Luddites were a social movement of British textile artisans in the early 19th century who protested, often by destroying mechanized looms, which they felt were leaving them out of work. Since then, however, the term Luddite has been commonly used to describe anyone opposed to technical progress or technical change. Also for March 16, 1933, the last anarcho-syndicalist newspaper, the FAUD, is ordered shut down in Germany. It was started as a union paper for the unemployed in Dresden, and his last journalistic holdout against the Nazi Party. Also on this date in 1965, Alice Herz, an 82-year-old activist, pacifist, immolates herself on a Detroit street corner at the campus of Wayne State University to protest the Vietnam War. Also on this date in 1988 in Iraq, massacre of the Kurds with mustard and nerve gases, which the U.S. and European weapons and chemical companies supplied. Also on this date, 2003, U.S. peace activist Rachel Corrie is killed by the Israeli military.
An Israeli bulldozer killed poor Rachel Corrie as she stood in its path in the township of Rafah. She lost her young life in an act of compassion, trying to protect the poor people of Gaza, whose homes are destroyed by tank shells and bulldozers, and whose plight is exploited by suicide bombers who kill in the name of the people of Gaza. But Rachel Corrie believed in nonviolent resistance, put herself in harm's way as a shield of the people, and paid with her life in a manner most brutal.
Rachel was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer made by Caterpillar Company in the United States while she is participating in a nonviolent movement protesting Israel's illegal 36-year occupation of the Palestinian territories, and specifically trying to save a Palestinian doctor's home from destruction. Eyewitnesses say that Rachel was negotiating with the driver for over 2 hours, was using a blowhorn and wearing a fluorescent orange vest. The driver knew where she was, but ran over anyways.
Rachel Corrie had 23 years. She was born in the town of Olympia, Washington, a skinny, messy, list-making chain smoker who volunteered to protect the Palestinian people who had become non-persons in the eyes of the media, so that people were suffering and no one was seeing.
The following is a short outtake of Rachel in a fifth grade presentation, and also an interview of her right before she's assassinated in Palestine. Rachel Corrie, Presente.
My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering, and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children. We have got to understand that the poor are all around us, and we're ignoring them. We have got to understand that these deaths are preventable. We have got to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. But we've got to understand that they are us. We are them.
This is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here. People are economically devastated because of the closure of the borders into Egypt and the extreme control of the Gazan economy by Israel. I came to look at the aftermath of a place where 25 greenhouses had been demolished on the other side of Rafah, destroying the livelihoods of about 300 people. And that had taken place while they rounded up about 150 men, held them under a sniper tower, and shot around them to contain the men, the farmers in the area. So I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying.
And turn Rachel Curry into a non-person. Oh, but you philosophize disgrace, criticize all fears. Bury the rag deep in your face, 'cause now is the time for your tears.
Lastly on a state in 2006. My name is Rachel Curry. A one-act play due to open this month at New York Theater Workshop was canceled 6 weeks ago under Jewish lobby pressure in New York. This week in Radical History for March 17th, German-American anarchist Johann Most dies in Cincinnati on this date in 1906. Most, perhaps best known for his thoughts and promotion of the idea of propaganda of the deed, which promotes insurrection and perhaps revolution.
This is your Radio News reporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, March 17th, in 1912, American civil rights activist Bayard Rustin was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Rustin's political organizing career was very dynamic. Throughout his life, he protested and campaigned against segregation laws, fought an alliance with the Japanese Americans in U.S. internment camps, organized against British rule in India and Africa, and advocated for gay rights. After adopting a strict nonviolent philosophy, Rustin counseled civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. and helped form the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, from which he was later forced to resign because he was openly gay. Due to his sexuality, Rustin was largely written out of civil rights history, and his enormous influence was heavily silenced. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on March 17th, more white justice in 1934. Thousands of blacks battled the police in New York to protest the Scottsboro trial. The Scottsboro trial originally were 9 young black defendants, some of them were minors, accused of gang raping 2 fellow hobo white women on a freight train. 8 were quickly convicted in a mob atmosphere at trial. The juries were entirely white, their attorneys had little experience of criminal law, and the judge gave them no time to prepare for their cases. As each case went to the jury, the judge would start the next trial while the previous jury was still deliberating. All but one of these black defendants were sentenced to death on rape convictions. Also March 17th, 2 quick items, 1960. President Eisenhower authorizes secret training of Cuban exiles for an invasion into Cuba. And in 1988, U.S. soldiers are sent to Honduras to protect American interests. This week in Radical History for March 18th. In 1871, the Paris Commune begins. For 2 months, Paris was governed by anarcho-syndicalists, local citizens groups known as communes. These lower middle-class folk, disenfranchised because of the war and the ever-increasing disparity between the bourgeoisie class governing from Versailles and the working folk on the streets of Paris. The German-backed Versailles government forces would eventually overrun the Commune's National Guard units. In all, perhaps 30,000 people died, 50,000 imprisoned or executed, and it was reported that well over 7,000 was sent in exile. The Paris Commune of 1871.
On this day, March 18th, in 1969, during the Vietnam War, the U.S. Air Force initiated Operation Menu and began bombing Cambodia. Despite Cambodia's official declaration of its neutrality, South Vietnamese liberation troops often use Cambodia as a base. After being warned by the U.S. to ban the South Vietnamese from their soil, the neutral country of Cambodia became the target for this massive secret bombing campaign under President Richard Nixon. Over the next 14 months, the U.S. military showered more bombs on Cambodia than the total amount dropped by the Allies during all of World War II. These brutal bombings were hidden from the American public, but the information eventually leaked out, provoking public outrage in the U.S. And then the government vowed to never bomb civilians again.
This week in Radical History for March 19, 1935, over 100 injured and $2 million worth of white property destroyed as riots break out in Harlem after a black man's eye is gouged out by policemen. New York City Mayor LaGuardia later refuses to release the study which blamed the violence on the police brutality. Also in New York in 1970, 200 women seized the New York offices of Lady Holmes Journal, demanding that they rename the magazine Women's Liberation Journal. The protest was led by groups like the National Organization of Women, Red Stockings New York Radical Feminist, and Older Women's League.
On this day, March 20th in 1620, the Dutch East India Company was established by a group of Dutch merchants and independent trading companies. Marking the beginning of their 21-year monopoly over the spice trade in East Asia, they forcefully colonized any territory they desired and often enslaved the indigenous people. Many countries like Indonesia and South Africa are still struggling to recover from the company's oppressive, destructive, and violent legacy.
Also on March 20, 2003, Bush and Blair attack Iraq in violation of international law and UN mandates. 24 Tomahawk missiles and four 200,000-pound bunker buster bombs with pinpoint accuracy are fired at Saddam Hussein in a shock and awe attempt to decapitate Iraq leadership. Not one of them hit the intended target. As each, quote, modern war becomes more and more potent, supposedly with more and more accurate targeting abilities, funny isn't how more civilian non-combatants are dying compared to the ratio of combatants. Like this last Gulf War, 1 million Iraqis are dead, double that amount is wounded, and over 4 million displaced. All while the United States casualties only suffered 4,000.
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 21st in 1617, it is said that Pocahontas died in Gravesend, England. Well, let's take a moment to correct Disney's portrayal of Pocahontas. Her real name was Matoaka, and she was the daughter of a Powhatan chief. She would have been about 10 at the time it is said that she rescued the Englishman John Smith. Pocahontas was later captured, married off to a man named John Rolfe, and transported to England, where she was used as propaganda to support the English colonies in Virginia. She died of disease in England at the age of 21. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on March 21st, 1907, on Honduras, Marines land during war with Nicaragua to protect U.S. interests, like they did in 1903 and will do again in 1911, 1912, 1919, and 1982. Also on March 21st, 1960, South Africa, Sharpeville massacre of 69 people murdered by police during protest of apartheid laws. Also on that date, 1965, Viola Liuzu, a civil rights worker from Michigan and mother of four, was murdered while transporting civil rights workers after the Selma to Montgomery march. Four members of the KKK would be arrested. One of them was a paid informant of the FBI. During the trial, she was described as a white nigger. This racial baiting tactic worked, for all four would eventually be found not guilty of her killing. Last in the state in 1985, South Africa again. During her funeral march of the three killed in Sharpsville Memorial Demo, South African police killed 19 more innocent people. This week in Radical History for March 22nd, I only have a couple items. 1905 in France, the trial of Alexandre Jacob and his gang began on March 8th, concludes in a guilty verdict. Jacob was a burglar member of the Anarchist Workers of the Night gang, credited with 150 burglaries. The gang was formed with his companion Rose Roux, his mother Marie Berthieu, and others. For 3 years during their spree, they methodically planned their jobs based on railroad networks and schedules, targeting rich people's homes, hotels, castles, and churches. not for personal gain, but with the intent to attack the powerful and rich while creating a forum for disruption of the social world. He'd receive life imprisonment and other members between 5 and 20 years. Lastly, in 1972, Congress approves the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA, which has not ratified enough states to ever become constitutional federal law.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح.
WZBC Newton.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Today our entire program consists of our conversation with Tufts University anthropologist Tom Aboud, author of the book Colonial Jerusalem. A year ago, when Colonial Jerusalem first came out, we had a conversation with Tom and vowed at that time we would continue that conversation, and today we do so. We sat down with Tom in his office at Tufts University. Tom, thank you for joining us on This Week in Palestine.
Nice to be here, as usual.
It's wonderful to have you. You've written a very important book called Colonial Jerusalem, the goal of which is to lay the groundwork for helping us understand what is happening in Jerusalem as we speak. Mm-hmm. About a year ago, we had our first conversation about the book on This Week in Palestine, and now we're returning to continue the conversation. But before we do, I would like to take a minute to hear about you, your background, your family, your roots, your identity as a Palestinian, and what that means to you.
Yes. Well, you know, actually, my family is mostly Lebanese. I'm a Lebanese-American, born here. My family came from Lebanon, but came from the Middle East at a time before the nation-state system had sort of established itself. This, what one of my advisors called this horrible European invention called the nation-state system, was brought pretty late, historically pretty late, to the Middle East region. So actually, when my family came, there was no nation-state of Lebanon, nation-state of Syria with distinct boundaries. And people in Lebanon and Palestine had a real integrated kind of life. The people in the northern Galilee in Palestine, northern Palestine, had more often an orientation toward Beirut than they did to Jerusalem or Jaffa. So the area is really quite, there are certain continuities today about the politics of boundaries and borders that have their root in the modern, sort of in the colonial period that ushered in this horrible series of boundaries and borders, which we're seeing unravel a bit now.
Right.
Pretty violently.
Right.
And the partition of Palestine affected the entire region, affected people all over the region, who, not least of which the Lebanese, who were then inundated with hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees overnight. I mean, the United States is quibbling about taking in 2,000, 3,500 Syrian refugees, you know, and a country like Lebanon is taken in, both with the recent Syrian refugees and the Palestinian refugees, a population that's over one-fifth of their entire population.
Yes.
So, you know, I got interested in the politics of Palestine early on in high school and then in college, when the politics of Palestine, some of the political debates and the activism around it, like in the late 80s, was not nearly what it is now, as you know well know, John. And on college campuses, it was a very fringe thing to be a part of, the Palestine Solidarity War. Now at Tufts, it's the Students for Justice in Palestine is one of the largest groups on campus and probably the most energetic. So I've seen I'm old enough now to have seen that period from the late 80s to now and seen how activism has really been shaped or changed and how it's shaped the discourse in this country around the issue. Yeah, I'm trying to think what best to say. You know, I am always interested in trying to steer conversation toward the politics of the region and away from my own particular issues. But I think I've learned a lot, and I continue to learn a lot by these students who do Palestine solidarity work. You know, on Tufts campus, about a third of the group are American Jews, including the president, I believe, this year. The whole intellectual landscape, the whole landscape, political landscape on college campuses has changed radically, and I know you know that, having been politically active yourself in the Boston area and elsewhere for a long time. It's just a whole different game.
Very encouraging.
Very encouraging.
Very encouraging. Knowing where we've come from, and knowing what
exactly.
It was like just a few years ago.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Almost immediately after occupying East Jerusalem in 1967, Israel began expanding the city's borders. Jerusalem literally now goes from southern Ramallah to northern Bethlehem.
That's right.
And almost to the Jordan Valley, and goes right up to the heights.
Yes.
Talk about why Israel did that. What is the strategy of expanding the borders of Jerusalem? What does it have to do with the strategy for the occupation?
Yes. Well, what I argue in the book and what I think is very clearly the case, Israel makes this evidently true with every day that passes, which is that they're interested in taking as much land as they can from the Palestinians with as few Palestinians on that land. And when they conquered East Jerusalem in 1967, having basically ethnically cleansed West Jerusalem in 48 of nearly every last Palestinian there, West Jerusalem was owned overwhelmingly by Palestinian families, and what is today West Jerusalem. And those families were overwhelmingly, sort of 99% of the Palestinian population was ejected. Okay, so in 67, Israel kind of finished the game by appropriating and colonizing, indeed, East Jerusalem. But they made very clear, and if you look at some of the internal Israeli planning documents and you talk to Israelis who were planners at the time involved in city politics and city planning, the trajectory, the sort of goal was very clear: to take as much Palestinian land as possible, redraw the boundaries of Jerusalem in a way that took in hundreds of, well, indeed, tens of thousands of dunams of land, with as few Palestinian people living on that land. So entire village land would be taken, or nearly an entire village like Beit Hanina's land would be taken, but the people of Beit Hanina would be left on the other side of the newly drawn Israeli boundary. This is a racial project. I mean, what else would one call this? This is racist orientation, and that Israeli planners and politicians were very honest about this. They didn't necessarily say it publicly at the time, but it's come out now that this was in fact their guiding logic. And that was so they could make a claim, just as they have tried to make on the entire country, based on demographic dominance. So if there were no settlers in East Jerusalem and a huge, even larger Palestinian presence than exists now, it would be difficult for Israel to try to make the claim to the international community that this is part of Israel. But if you could get rid of Palestinians, redrawing the boundaries in a way that excluded them, and move in a couple hundred thousand Jewish settlers, which they've done since 1967, then you can say, oh, well, look, half of the population of East Jerusalem are Israeli Jews. And therefore, this is our city, this is our part of our city as well. But it's important to understand for those, you know, I'm an urban anthropologist who's interested in urban politics and urban planning. It's important to understand, we often forget that a city, when we're talking about the city's population or the city's dimensions, we're not talking about some sort of guidelines or borders that came down from the heavens. These are lines that are drawn by human hands, and they can be redrawn, and they can be undrawn, and they can be constituted, and they always are constituted by people who have the power to draw those lines. So too with Jerusalem. Jerusalem has this sort of aura of being this eternal symbolic city. There's nothing eternal about it. Until about 110 years ago, Jerusalem was just the city within the old city walls. That was Jerusalem, right. One square kilometer. Right. And by now it's 70 times that large. And so I think that's a very political exercise, drawing boundaries and being able to say, if you have power, being able to say who belongs, who's inside and who's outside. And unfortunately, the Israeli state has been the one force that's been able to do that, totally in violation of international law.
Right.
No one else in the world, no other country in the world recognizes this as anything but illegal, including the United States.
And Jerusalem now sweeps in several Palestinian villages. They were not Jerusalem. Abu Dis was not Jerusalem.
That's right.
Not Jerusalem.
That's right.
It was Anata. It was, you know, yeah. These were, and which is probably why they build the wall, right? Wall has nothing
Indeed.
To do with security. It has to do with defining the land and, mm-hmm. as we would say, taking the land.
Yes.
Taking the land, making it very difficult to live on this land, particularly when your house is on one side of the wall and your fields are on the other.
Yes.
And we see that kind of thing constantly.
Now, that's happened in literally thousands of cases. I want to make one statement, John, about the wall, which you're correct to say is not primarily about security, but my big point in the book is to get us to think that even if it were about security, even if it did somehow make Israelis safer, which it does not, that's not the ethical question. That wouldn't justify it. A lot of things would make particular populations safer, that would violate human rights, that would violate civil liberties. You know, this government could put everybody under house arrest. That would make certain populations safer. It wouldn't be ethical. It would be antithetical to human rights, and it would be a violation of people's. So, A, the wall is illegal. It's been deemed illegal by the International Court of Justice, by the World Court, by the United Nations, by every country in the world recognizes it as an intrusion to occupied territory. But even if it weren't, it's a violation of people's land, people's livelihood, and people's human rights by constructing such an impediment, which has the sole, I think, its major goal is to separate, not just sort of through city boundaries, but by fortified city boundaries, a reality. That puts the wrong kind of people on the other side of the border, and Israelis on the side of the border they wish to annex.
And the way they're taking the land and houses in many instances is so inhumane. Mm-hmm. I remember a few years ago when we were there, we went to Sheikh Jarrah, mm-hmm. and we visited a family who had been in this house for generations. This particular compound actually was deeded by Jordan when Jordan was controlling the West Bank for refugees, for people that were Palestinians that were being driven off their land, had been there. But it's now part of East Jerusalem, and as you point out, Israelis, Jews are coming in, taking the land, populating the land, and so in this particular house, a Jewish family just moved in to part of the house, just absolutely took over part of the house,
yes.
and then gradually took over the whole house, mm-hmm. drove this family out, and that is repeating itself again and again and again, particularly in this compound of Sheikh Jarrah, but throughout the territory, and it's just an incredible, inhumane way of stealing people's homes and lands, and
yes,
and that's what's happening again and again and again.
Yes. I mean, it really underscores how cruel military occupation is and can be, and not just Israel's military occupation, but colonial domination and occupation more generally. I think it's important to step back a few, to go back a few steps, John, and emphasize the fact that though the Israeli government and its supporters in the United States and elsewhere have sought to depict Jerusalem as this unified city, Israel's eternal unified capital, quote unquote, the simple fact is, just to repeat, that East Jerusalem, every square inch of what's regarded as East Jerusalem, is seen internationally as occupied territory, conquered in violation and held in violation of international law. Now, one of the things the Geneva Convention, Fourth Geneva Convention, stipulates is that you cannot, when you are occupying a land, transform that land demographically or in terms of kicking people out or bringing people in, bringing settlers in or kicking the native population out. And so what you've described in Sheikh Jarrah is a situation where even if there were some claims to a particular land before 1948 that Israeli Jews had, and they weren't Israelis then because there was no Israel, then under by the terms of the United Nations and the international community recognizes that you cannot just go back in occupied territory and start kicking people out of people's homes or blowing up homes and moving Jewish settlers in. So say this in this case, some Israeli Jewish family had a claim to this land, which I don't think they do. I think this is an example of deceit in the highest form. But say that were the case, the Israeli government as an occupying force does not have the right to start swapping land and putting people here and moving settlers in and kicking Palestinians out. They do not have the right to transform or alter that land in any of those ways. They don't have the right to alter the currency, by the way. That's another violation of international law. What the United States did in Iraq, by the way, is a violation of these very same accords. You can't go in and start changing the economy and shifting the currency and all of that. Israel's done all of these things, and it's done it under the cover, and I see under the cover of this kind of mystification, you see it in representations from NPR to Fox News. You see recent stories on Jerusalem, and there's sort of some clash in East Jerusalem, or there's some land theft, or some home is demolished, or some Israeli soldier is attacked. And there's never even any mention that this is all happening in illegally occupied territory. They make it sound as though it were happening in Tel Aviv or New Jersey or somewhere. It's happening in a place that is being subjected to a harsh 47-year-old military occupation. So that's important, I think, to point out.
Yeah, the irony, of course, is how we worship private property in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly don't recognize its value in a colonial situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's for sure. Talk to us a bit about how Israel makes this all legal under this absentee property law, how it uses that to confiscate property on a very broad way. Talk to us about how that works.
Yeah, it has a long genealogy, and in fact, it is Israeli law. It's spun out of a series of laws in the late 40s, early 50s, in which Israel was kind of constructing a new legal landscape that was meant to appropriate Palestinian land, the land of Palestinian refugees, people who were pushed out of their country. What to do with this land? There was a whole legal redefinition of what the land would then become. It was no longer Palestinian private property. It became held by the custodian. It's a long sort of name, but basically there's a Israeli office called the Custodian of Absentee Property, which then took the land of so-called quote-unquote absentees and held it in Israeli state hands. Now, an absentee was defined as
it was defined in a kind of neutral way, but in fact it applied to Palestinians who were thrown out of their country. And they claimed that an absentee was somebody who, between, I believe it was May 15th, 1948 and October 1948, left Israel-Palestine for what was called an enemy country, which would be any country Israel defined it to be. In other words, they defined, they transformed Palestinian refugees into so-called absentees by defining their movement and their expulsion as that practice, as being the activity of an absentee. Their property that was then seized as absentee property, and then it was redistributed in the early 50s under a series of laws, one of which, the 1953 law, is still sacrosanct. The Israelis still hold it. It's still operative. And it basically allows the redistribution of Palestinian, quote-unquote, absentee property to Israeli Jews and to organizations that are for the that provide the land for the use and benefit exclusively of Israel's Jewish population. So, yeah, it's under this sort of legal... this set of legal terms and terminology and laws that are devised and are Israeli, it is Israeli law, but the law itself is in violation of international law.
But Israel says, well, these are people who, quote, left. Yeah. And we know they are not people who left. They were people who were forced out. And as you say, went to, quote, enemy territory, which is everything that borders Israel.
That's right.
Egypt,
where they could have gone.
Jordan,
Lebanon,
Syria. So they make that definition. They create the situation.
Yes.
And then they say, well, they left when really they were forced out. And then take their property, and it's rather incredible the way they make that argument.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how they're taking the land in so many instances.
Right. So in fact, those old title deeds that Palestinian exiles and refugees had for their land are no, they still hold, some of these families still have the keys to the home, they still have the deeds to the land or to the house, but within the Israeli legal system, those are null and void. The Israeli government doesn't recognize those. They've created new deeds, they've created new numbers for plots of land. They've given these homes overwhelmingly or sold them to Israeli Jewish families. So they would say, no, this the new Israeli Jewish family owns this house. Here's the deed we've created, but the whole act, the whole way of dispossessing these 700 at the time 750,000 people was itself a violation of international law and cruel and as a cruel if nothing else. I want to make one other point, though, John. You mentioned the way families were expelled and Palestinians were overwhelmingly, you know, expelled violently or fled their land in fear. But on one level, a point was made by the former Israeli, the late great Israeli human rights activist, civil libertarian Israel Shahak, who said it doesn't matter why refugees left.
That's right.
They've been prevented from coming back.
That's right.
It doesn't matter why anybody left their home. That doesn't mean that you somehow have the right to take it because they left because they feared war or they went to visit grandma in Lebanon.
Try that in this country, right?
Right.
Oh,
I
you
mean,
left. You want me?
Right. So they
left for a
times.
Few months.
Right.
You know, you went south, came back. Well,
and though there are still, though, you know, we're talking about Ilan Pape, the great Israeli historian who's going to be speaking in Boston in the coming days, he and other Israeli historians have demonstrated in an ironclad way that there was a policy, a concerted Israeli policy to drive the Palestinians out and to change the demographic realities. Okay, but nonetheless, there are still people who argue that that's not the case. The Israeli government's official position is opposite to that. But what everybody agrees around this question, everybody agrees, is that the Israeli government is preventing these people from coming back.
That's right.
And the Israeli government says that openly, and they say that it's because we want to protect the purity of the state or the demographic purity of the Jewish state, whatever. But nobody denies that they're preventing these refugees who have the right to come back to their lands from coming back.
Well, and that plays into the goal that you stated on top about Israel wanting to vacate the land, have Palestinians vacate the land. And you know, this is all part of it.
Right.
They want them gone, and if they can if they can get them out, then they have a means of not letting them come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens so often. Those Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem have a special resident designation. Talk to us about the unique qualities of Jerusalem residency and how that's used to separate Palestinians and their ability to move. But talk to us about Jerusalem residency.
Yes.
What it means for some and what it doesn't mean for others.
It's a very political classification. And after 1967, one of the ways that Israel sought to change the demographics in East Jerusalem was to, after they redrew the boundaries, only allow permanent, what they call permanent residency to those Palestinians who were present there at that moment. So if you were in the Gulf working with your family, you were from East Jerusalem, you owned a house there, but happened to be outside of the country when Israel conquered East Jerusalem in 67, you were considered an absentee. These are the 1967
right.
absentees. And your property was appropriated as absentee property. And therefore, you were not given, well, first of all, you, from the perspective of the Israeli government, you lost all property rights at that moment because it was no longer your property. It was absentee property held by the Israeli custodian of absentee property. So those Palestinians who were present there and were determined to have been present within the new boundaries reconstituted by Israel were generally given what was called sort of permanent residency. They became permanent residents, not Israeli citizens. Israeli Jews who became settlers in East Jerusalem are Israeli citizens, but the Palestinians are permanent residents. And they have paperwork that allows them to be present in the city unless they leave the country for a certain number of years. It varies from time. I think it was at one point 3 years. Then the Israelis can take their permanent residency away from them. So an Israeli who lives on the French Hill settlement can go back to her house, in second home in Florida or Brooklyn, and live there for as long as she wants and never be stripped of her Israeli citizenship or her right to live in a settlement in East Jerusalem. A Palestinian, I've seen this many, many times, it's happened repeatedly because Israel's interested in clearing out the city of the wrong kind of people, namely the Palestinian population. They go to study in New York, and they don't go back to visit East Jerusalem or Jerusalem for several years. And when they come back, the Israeli officials say, well, no, you don't actually have the right to be here anymore. We'll give you a tourist visa, or we will. But the right that you have here that was formally recognized by us is no longer recognized. And because we're the power, we have the power, we can deny you the legal right to live in your own city. Now, there are lots of very kind of cruel variations on the theme. I mean, for instance, Palestinians who, for whatever reason, usually because it's too expensive to live in Jerusalem, seek to build a house outside of Jerusalem, can have their residency, permanent residency status stripped from them. A Palestinian woman who marries a Palestinian man in Bethlehem or Hebron or some other place is pressured by the Israeli government to move out of Jerusalem, usually because the Israeli government will not grant the spouse, often a man, a husband, as opposed to a wife, will not grant that person legal residency in Jerusalem. So the family remains split. And the way the Israeli government has done this typically is to, they claim to be experts on Palestinian culture. And they claim that, well, of course, in Palestinian culture, the woman moves with the man toward his center of gravity. So, of course, a Palestinian woman in East Jerusalem, if she marries a man from Bethlehem, she should go there. He shouldn't be allowed to come here.
But if it's reversed.
If it's a man who marries
a man with Jerusalem residency marries a woman from Hebron.
Yes.
Can they live together in Jerusalem?
Not necessarily.
Right, that's what I thought.
They have to go. It's gendered in that way that I just described, but it doesn't guarantee if it's a man who marries a woman from a Jerusalemite man marries a non-Jerusalemite woman that the woman can automatically come to Jerusalem. It goes through a sort of bureaucratic process, which, as you can imagine, is not sort of consistent and principled and above board. And it's again, in violation of international law for Israel to put even any of these stipulations on movement in and out.
But isn't it safe to say it would be very rare that Israel would allow that woman to live with her husband in Jerusalem? Because we hear
very rare.
Story after story of the people that cannot live together.
Cases like this have either been denied or they've gone through this protracted bureaucratic process in which people have to petition, and it takes years, even if they finally win the right for the spouse to be there legally. Mm-hmm. It may take years. It may take thousands of dollars of legal fees. It may take the sort of toll on people that is not often seen in this conflict, which is emotional, which is about trauma. You know, it's about things you can't easily measure. But people's lives are destroyed. People's lives are made so uncertain that they can't plan. For instance, a couple like this who's fighting for residency in Jerusalem can't plan to go abroad for a period and take a Fulbright award, because by leaving they may jeopardize both of their rights to come back. These are all the sort of micro ways in which military occupation and, I argue, colonial rule is really cruel and obscenely cruel. So what Israel has sought to do, because as I mentioned in the beginning of the interview, the goal was to create a certain demographic reality in Jerusalem, whereby in East Jerusalem, the Palestinian population would never be more than, I think, in the entire city, they wanted the Palestinian population never to be more than 28% of the entire population, right? They've lost that demographic battle. They've lost that demographic battle because the Palestinian population in East Jerusalem is now majority. There's about probably 54% of East Jerusalem's population is Palestinian. And the Jewish settlers in East Jerusalem are about 45-46% of the population. But there was a demographic and kind of a racial design here to limit the number of Palestinian Muslims and Christians and increase the number of Israeli Jews in the city. Okay, so given that the Palestinians were the vast majority of East Jerusalem and are still the majority, there had to be these legal and bureaucratic ways to get to change the demographic realities. One of which is to kick people out of their homes and kick them out of the city. The other is to make the situation there so unbearable that they so-called, quote-unquote, voluntarily move to a neighboring city where they can build a house, where they can get permission to build a home, where they can survive financially. And another way is to deny people who marry each other with these residency permit issues, deny the spouse of the Jerusalem resident from coming into Jerusalem. So what's a family supposed to do? Well, eventually the Israeli government hopes they will just break down and then move out to where the other spouse can be. These are very, clever and sinister bureaucratic processes.
But if I'm a Palestinian, I live in Bethlehem or Hebron, I cannot go to Jerusalem because I don't have Jerusalem. I can't even go there to visit. I can't, even on the holidays, I can't go there.
By this day and age, by this point, that's overwhelmingly true. I once did about a year and a half ago, I actually added it all up, and I think it's safe to say that over 80% of the Palestinian population cannot travel to Jerusalem to this day, legally. And if they're caught entering without Israeli, quote-unquote, permission, they can be imprisoned, they can be tortured, they can be beaten. So Israel is really hermetically sealed off the city. Palestinians in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem or Ramallah, who can see Jerusalem from their home, they cannot cross into the city, usually even to pray or shop or to see other family members. During the month of Ramadan, there's a negotiation in which the Israeli government permits Palestinian Muslims to go to their holy site and pray for one day and then leave the city. But they regulate entry and entrance and exit in that way. And yeah, it's true. I mean, there are. I taught at Bir Zeit University a few years ago, and I had a class of. Now, Bir Zeit University is about 10 miles north of the Jerusalem border, maybe 15 miles north. And these young undergrads that I taught, about 20 of them in this class, would have, if they were my age, 20 years older, would have been going to Jerusalem several times a year, and maybe even been working there, maybe even been living there, but going back to their parents' house in Ramallah once a week or whatever. I asked them, all 20 of them, how many of these 22-year-olds had ever been to Jerusalem? Only 3 of 21 or 22 people had ever even been to the city in their 22 years. So this is a blatant, deliberate policy to keep Palestinians out of Jerusalem so as to more effectively make a claim on the city.
Right. Now in your book, Colonial Jerusalem, you write an entire chapter on the use of terrorism and fear on the part of the Israeli military and also Jewish settlers to police the Palestinian population, control the population, choose your word. But in particular, you focus on how men and boys are treated at checkpoints, are treated on the streets, are treated when they try to go to school or when they try to go to their fields, within their own villages, on their own land. Talk to us about this phenomenon of control and what impact that has on, say, the prison population.
Mm. Well, this is a very good question. Again, backing up a little bit in time, it wasn't really until the early 90s, I think it was around 93, 94, when the Israeli government began to put up checkpoints that enveloped Jerusalem. It's often, many people who do work on this subject today don't understand that until about 1992, 93, you could drive, you could get in your blue-plated Palestinian car, Gaza plates or West Bank plates, and drive wherever you wanted in the country. There were no checkpoints. There might be they might throw up a checkpoint impromptu and keep people from driving down the street, the Israeli government. But there was a time until the early 90s where you could get in your car in Gaza City, with your Palestinian license plate, and drive all the way up to the Golan Heights without going through one checkpoint. And in the last 25 years, what's happened is that Israel, in an attempt to sort of create facts on the ground and appropriate Jerusalem, has sought to insulate the city with all these checkpoints that police and regulate who can come in, who can leave. Usually they're more interested in people coming in. Palestinians all want to leave. They don't care about that. That's fine. They'll help them do that. But you now, since the early to mid-90s, need to have Israeli permission to enter the city. And in the last 10 years, those walls, those checkpoints have become ever tighter, ever more, ever harsher, ever more difficult to cross. And crossing over has become more criminalized. So what happens when you try to enter one of these, there are probably around roughly 10 checkpoints that envelop the whole area that Israel considers Jerusalem. And to go through these checkpoints, you're basically, when you drive through, for one, the Israeli soldiers are looking at what kind of license plates you have. If you have a Palestinian license plate, Palestinians are given different color license plates than Israelis, Israeli citizens, then you can't come in. Okay, by definition, you can't come in. Then they look at who's in the car. And if you're a man in the car, they begin to sort of racially profile you or ethnically profile you, however you wish to look at it. And if they suspect, quote unquote, that you are a Palestinian and not an Israeli Jew or an Israeli settler, then they are going to stop you and they're going to determine whether you can come into the city, to your own city or not. And if you are trying to cross that checkpoint and you do not have an Israeli permission, permission to enter, you will be held, detained, imprisoned, beaten, any number of those things. You won't just necessarily... It used to be maybe 20 years ago when you tried to do that and you didn't have permission, they would just send you back. Now if you try to cross over without Israeli documents, they won't just send you back. They'll usually detain you, and you could meet, you know, a very violent fate. So it's a very... and if you... So this is part of a longer story, but this is what's happened in the last 25 years. And it was started under the Labor government, Israeli Labor government, which sought to create an arrangement that they called one based on hafrada, or separation. Mm-hmm. Okay, Palestinians over here, we Israeli Jews over here. And we're gonna create that separation by checkpoints and walls if we have to. We're going to sort of divorce ourselves from the major Palestinian population concentrations, but take all of their land. It was an old continuation of the old idea of maximum Palestinian land, minimum Palestinian people. And, you know, the Labor government was actually more harsher in this way than Likud. In fact, I remember when Netanyahu was elected in 96, I was doing some research as a younger student at the time, and the Labor government had begun to put up these checkpoints. When Likud came to power, the checkpoints stayed, but it was much easier to travel into Jerusalem than it had been under the Labor Party. Because the Likud party was never, and I don't think to this day, are of the belief that any of the areas Palestinians live in Palestine belong to the Palestinians or will ever belong to the Palestinians. There was a difference between Labor and Likud. The Labor government recognized under the terms of the Oslo government, Oslo Accord they created, that there actually were these areas that were under Palestinian sovereignty. And Likud never acknowledged that sovereignty. Now, no one in the Israeli government really acknowledges that sovereignty. Oslo is long, long dead. But it was the Israeli government that started this real harsh policy of checkpoints and separation. And increased, it was under the Israeli Labor Party in the 90s, under the Barak government in the late 90s, that actually increased settlement building at the higher rate than it had ever been before. Higher than it had been under Netanyahu in the previous government. And every bit as intense as it would become under the Sharon government in the years during and after the Second Intifada.
Now we're getting to the end of our time, but I wonder whether you see any hope for the resistance to this occupation. Mm. Palestinians are not going away. They're not going to stop resisting. I think Israel would love it if they did. I think they have expected that this might happen in response to their harsh and cruel separation laws and detention laws and incarcerations, huge numbers of prisoners being held, etc. But the occupation doesn't seem to be going away. Do you see any hope for the resistance? And if so, what do you see?
That's a really good question. I don't honestly see much hope in ending Israel's occupation without a change in the United States government's policies, without a change in the United States citizens' attitudes toward this conflict, which are changing rapidly. You know, we were talking earlier, there's great change in the American Jewish community, especially among the younger generations, in opposition to what Israel's doing and how they're taking land and oppressing Palestinians, taking their land, committing really horrible human rights abuses. But given the balance of power, I'm not too hopeful that Israel's occupation will end without an end to the U.S. government's support for that occupation. You know, Noam Chomsky has often said that whenever you criticize Israel, or Israel's invasion or Israel's occupation, you have to attach U.S. to that. You have to say the U.S.-Israel occupation, the U.S.-Israel invasion of Lebanon. Because the Israeli government doesn't do anything that the United States government doesn't give a green light to. And so sometimes the U.S. government would wish Israel didn't do X, Y, or Z. But they haven't yet been able to or been willing to stop them from doing that. And they arm them to the teeth. And they give them moral sanction and protection at the United Nations. Until that changes, the Israeli government will not on its own stop occupying this land. They will not.
What's difficult, I think, for us is to see some optimism in the way U.S. citizens and students, et cetera, are beginning to shift in terms of their approach to Israel, but not the government. I mean, even with this election now, Hillary Clinton has made outrageous kinds of statements and is taking all kinds of money from wealthy Jews in this country, and we see no movement in Congress whatsoever. So until I think we're able to make some kind of political changes or pressure on our political leaders, we're not going to see it. But we're not just there yet.
No, we're not.
We're not there yet.
You're right. So the hope is that what happens among grassroots activists, projects, and among, at universities and within church groups is will change the government's policy.
Yeah.
But it hasn't yet. You're absolutely right. It hasn't yet. We can only hope. I don't think, you know, the Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation is pretty heroic and has been able to do many amazing things. But until I really am firmly of the belief that the Palestinians alone cannot kick out the Israeli settlers, soldiers, military, sort of the military structures that impinge on them. They can do a lot of amazing, and you know, they're resisting in ways that are saying very clearly to the Israelis, we're not going away, you cannot break us, and you will not get rid of us. And that's true. But if we could change our government's policy, we could change things there pretty quickly overnight if the U.S. government had a will to actually stop supporting and funding Israel's illegal occupation. There are those who believe, and I believe too, that just the threat of the cut of aid to Israel would get them to change their policies very quickly. You wouldn't even have to cut aid, just threaten Israel that aid will be cut and protection at the UN will be
stopped. And I think movements like the BDS movement are creating a situation where Israel increasingly is being seen as a pariah state.
Mm-hmm.
But until we push that a lot further, and it begins to make the political impact that we need, change isn't going to happen. But we do see that. We certainly do see an ability of movements in the United States to create the situation where Israel is, quote, a pariah state. And they're responding to that. They're pouring money. And even now, state by state, they're trying to make BDS illegal.
That's right.
Illegal. So they are responding. So to some extent, it's successful. But boy, do we have a long way to go.
We certainly do.
Yeah.
We certainly do. But it's an important, it's a necessary but not sufficient activity.
Yeah.
Without it, there's no hope. But you need to build on that.
Well, as you point out, without it making an impact on our government, without it making a political impact on votes in Congress, it isn't going to happen. Yeah. Well, Tom, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for speaking with us on This Week in Palestine.
My pleasure.
And I hope we'll do this again and often, because your insights are wonderful. And again, I'm hoping people will read your book, Colonial Jerusalem. A lot of things that we talk about quickly here in the last 40 minutes or so are much clearer in your book.
Oh,
you lay it out beautifully. And so I encourage people to read Colonial Jerusalem.
Okay.
Tom, thanks very much.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you.
That was a conversation with Tufts University anthropologist Tom Abood, author of the book Colonial Jerusalem. And that is our program this morning.
Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature Israeli new historian Ilan Pape speaking at Harvard University. That is next Sunday morning on This Week in Palestine.
This is some abstract question. These are actually people's jobs, people's livelihoods, people's life chances, people's families we're talking about. And I say, don't put them at risk. Don't take this leap in the dark.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. In the week that the Beatles producer George Martin died, we have a look at another Beatle whose time was not allowed to run its course. The brains behind the band, John Lennon, was assassinated in New York in 1980 under a US intelligence program called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence propaganda for short. We find out what he thought about voting for mayors. And the Turkish government send the police in to take over the country's biggest opposition paper, which just happens to be publishing evidence of the president's corruption. We hear from the English edition's executive editor an exclusive interview. Plus, two big anniversaries of great British cover-ups this week. It's 30 years since the 1986 assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and also 20 since the Dunblane murders of 20 Scottish primary school children and their teachers by paedophile suspect Thomas Hamilton, who overruled the police advice for him to have his gun licence taken away. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But we start this week by looking at the final English film made by one of Britain's greatest ever comedians, Rick Mayall. Why has it still not been shown through most of our cinemas or on British television? Could it be because Rick plays a character with controversial views about the war on terror? Well, I'm joined by Diane Jessie Miller now on the line, at least I hope I am. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the Politics Show. We'll have to try that a little bit later in the show. Maybe we can start, Martin, by having a look at Libya and the takeover of that country we were talking about earlier on.
Well, as I understand from what Obama's been saying, is he was not that keen to get involved in the attempt to overthrow Gaddafi, which is effectively what it was. It was talked about as a humanitarian mission to prevent the Libyans using air power against demonstrators in Benghazi, although there's no evidence that they did in fact use air power against demonstrators in Benghazi. As the Russians pointed out, their satellites showed no evidence that the Libyans were using air power against demonstrators. Of course, that you wouldn't use air power against demonstrators, there's not really much point. So Obama is kind of saying, well, it's the British and the American, the British and the French were leading from the front here, and they insisted that we should try and overthrow Gaddafi. I was a bit iffy about it, but I'm now complaining because you didn't do enough subsequently to, you know, help us to stabilise the situation in Libya. Now, in actual fact, I think everybody's dissimulating here. I think the plan to take down the Gaddafi regime was put together in advance. We know that Operation Southern Mistral 2011 was a British and French air war game based in the south of France, which was very, very similar and was just about ready to go just as the demonstrations broke out in Libya. Then the call for a no-fly zone was made, and in actual fact that was part of the war game Southern Mistral 2011, which people can look up online if they don't believe this. So in other words, there was an orchestrated plan to take down Gaddafi, which involved both the British, the French, and I believe the Americans. I think that Obama is being disingenuous there. But of course, the other factor that's problematic now for the Americans is the Benghazi incident when their ambassador was assassinated, and Hillary Clinton, of course, is in the firing line from the Republicans in the US about that. And of course, what they were doing there, what's come out if you read between the lines, is that they were getting Islamist militants and Islamist and weaponry from the Libyan army. And they were being shipped from Benghazi to Syria via Turkey. So both weapons and militants were going. So Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who was the head of the Islamic fighting group in Libya, then turns up in Syria as a field commander for the so-called Free Syrian Army, even though he's actually a native of Benghazi. But of course, somebody like him has been in and out of custody, but has actually been working with British intelligence services for many, many years. So there's an awful lot of sleight of hand and delusion going on here. But nevertheless, it should also be clear to most people that the intervention in Libya was A, illegal, and B, catastrophic. Thousands of people died, and all we've done is created another mess, just like Iraq. And of course, as Hillary Clinton said about Gaddafi, we saw, he died. Now, that is simply illegal. I mean, Gaddafi was shot through the head with a bayonet up his backside by militants probably working with French special forces.
The situation bringing it back up today, is that the United Nations is just saying today ISIS in Libya is presenting itself as the key bulwark against any kind of action by Western powers there. So ISIS is starting to thrive over there in the chaos that's been left since the removal of Gaddafi.
Well, I would argue that the evidence piles up that ISIS, both in Libya and elsewhere, is being surreptitiously manipulated by Western intelligence services. What they're providing is another excuse for the Western powers to intervene. And do you know what they're going to do? They're going to seize the oil industry to make sure that it doesn't fall into ISIS hands, because as we know, in Syria they got hold of the oil industry, and that was what funded them for years. But it only funded them for years because the Turkish military and the Turkish government were allowing them to ship the oil out of Syria and sell it on the international black market, mainly to the Israelis. And of course, this is all shadow play and manipulation. Underlying all of this, as the Russian general staff well know, as the Iranian general staff well know, is that most militant Islamist groups are being funded and directed by Saudi Arabia, by Qatar and the other Gulf countries, which are not democracies by any stretch of the imagination, and by NATO intelligence services, including MIT in Turkey, CIA and MI6. And then we say, oh, look, we've got to go invading these countries to try and stop ISIS, whereas everybody who's objectively looked at it realises that ISIS and the Western intelligence services are effectively the same organisation.
I mean, is it really just all about oil?
Yes, to a large extent it is. It's about...
Why? Why is oil so... I mean, are we just addicted to this stuff?
Well, it's not a question of us being addicted to it. The main purpose of intervention in Africa and the Middle East by the Western powers is to prevent the Chinese getting her hands on the oil.
So all these
and
people...
also, of course, the main purpose of the war in Syria is to build a pipeline, a gas pipeline through Syria from Qatar, which will then prevent the Russians being the main suppliers to the east, to the Europe, the Western Europeans. So it's all about pipelines and geostrategic manoeuvrings. And this is not so much to do with we want the oil, it's more or the gas. It's more to prevent our geopolitical opponents from getting their hands on the oil and the gas.
So if the country's left in chaos,
yes,
then
it doesn't matter.
Do these things.
Yes, indeed. And so the minimum, if you drive the country to chaos and drive them off the international oil market,
are we going to end up with the whole of the Middle East in chaos?
It's already happening, and you know the people are on the move, as we know, arriving in Greece as we speak at 3,000 a day, and that is the result of our disastrous policies over the last 20 years under various regimes in this country. And you know, all of those chickens are coming home to roost in a big flock, aren't they?
BCFM. Well, hopefully I've got Diane Jessie Miller on the line now. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the Politics Show. We'll try again.
Hello, how are you doing?
Oh, fantastic. Yes.
You can hear me now. Technology, it's our saviour and our fear. It's all manner of things.
Well done. Thanks for getting to us on the phone. Skype sort of let us down. But anyway, this film, am I right in saying that this was the very last film that he made in Britain, Rick Mayall?
It was his last UK feature, yeah. He did another film afterwards, a Dutch feature, but I believe he only plays a cameo in it, but I don't know because I've not seen it. But yeah, this is... what I'm led to believe is the last major film role that he did, especially in the UK.
Can you just tell us what it was like to work with him? Because I know that you were kind of an amateur filmmaker, weren't you? You come to this kind of fresh, without going through the kind of professional industry. What was it like working with Rick?
It was amazing to work with someone like Rick. I mean, I got very lucky getting Rick involved in it. Like you said, it was a first-time filmmaker. I mean, I didn't write any short films or anything. I went straight into features because these subjects spoke to me so much that I wanted to get them into the masses. So when I wrote the script, we knew we had to get somebody of some kind of notoriety in it to give it the clout that it might need. And Rick was one of the choices, and we got really lucky. He went through his agent, so not through a back door or anything like that, straight through the front door. His agent sent him the script on the Friday, and I got a phone call on the Monday saying that Rick wanted to do it. Based on the script.
Fantastic. Well, let's have a little listen to a clip from the film now. Hope you don't mind me borrowing a little bit of your copyright. And this is where there's a discussion in the film with Rick involved about the September the 11th attacks and whether or not you're some kind of loony to really question some of the big assumptions that we're being told about them. So let's have a listen to that now. And it's from Diane Jessie Miller's film One by One.
The only kind of building blocks that require the blocks from the side, it falls over at that point. But then explain to me how, when an aeroplane was flown into one of the Twin Towers on September the 11th, that building collapsed in on itself. What about the other tower? Scientifically, mathematically, blockily, those buildings should have fallen over. Not inwards. I mean, I would see the idea that by some sort of miracle one of those towers would have collapsed in on itself. But both of them? I'm afraid I doubted that the moment I watched it happen live. It is inconceivable that those planes brought those buildings there. But watch a controlled demolition. It looks the same. If a picture says 1,000 words, and our eyes can see 1,000 lives, see it to believe.
Who did that? Why would they?
Fear. 9/11, like 7/7, is pure fear. Nothing more. September 11th, 2001, was a ruse, a show, a charade that even child could identify.
A charade, a child could identify. Well, what made you write about these things, Diane?
Well, 9/11 was something that I was quite passionate about. I think it was probably one of the first moments I started to realise that things weren't quite as we were led to believe they were in the world. I mean, I was just 21 when 9/11 happened. And I think anyone of my generation or above can tell you exactly where they were when it happened. It was our Kennedy, so to speak. And when I watched it, I mean, I'm quite a logical person, and I couldn't believe that the buildings didn't fall over. That just seemed like child's play to me, that if you've got a structure and you hit the side of it, it doesn't collapse in on itself, it falls over. I mean, I'm no engineer, I'm no scientist, I'm not a specialist about the 9/11 truth movement or anything like that. All I used for this scene was what my logic dictated. Like I said, it's a charade that even a child could see, and that's where that kind of came from.
Well, why haven't we seen it on our TV screens or on prime time on a Saturday night? Why haven't we seen it yet?
We've been trying. I mean, we started doing this film 7 years ago, and it's been a long, long, arduous process at times. And, I mean, the film was actually finished in 2013, so 6 years this December, sorry, 3 years this December the film's been finished. We did submit to most of the major film festivals, sent it into TV stations and such like, and no one's kind of wanted to touch it. I mean, even after, God love him, even after Rick died, we, as a team, we decided that we weren't going to do any publicity for a month, kind of in respect of Rick. But what did come out of that is that we weren't even put in any of the press after Rick died. It was there's nothing about our film in any of the body of work at all. I don't know is the answer.
But it's annoying, isn't it? I'd like to see it. I want to sit down on Saturday night and watch your film. And it seems to me as if there may be a sensitivity about the issues that Rick is bringing about there, even though he's one of the best-loved comedians in the country. Have you actually had any real sort of conversations with commissioning editors and channel controllers and things that you can relate to us about the kinds of reasons they've given you that they don't want to show your film?
No, we've had nothing like that. I mean, we were lucky enough to find an independent distributor last year called Film Vault, who have kind of come on board and tried to use all their channels to get it in the door. And although there's been kind of negotiations, it's never kind of got anywhere. But I've never been privy to those conversations. So what I've been doing in the background is trying to get as many people wanting to see this film via social media, but it is just me trying to do it. So anyone that goes to our Facebook page will see we've got just over 1,500 people, and myself and my business partner, Ash, we have been trying to build that audience up over the last 5 years, but I don't know. I can't answer that. I can't help but feel there's something that's kind of not letting it get through the door, which is why we've gone for a DVD release, and we're doing it through kind of, we're ticking the boxes, if you like. We are putting in for official BBFC certification, which is like the 18 rating or 15 rating, so that if we want to put it into a mainstream store, we can do that. We've got everything in place to do so. And then there's really no excuses. I mean, there's no excuses not for a chain to take the DVD and put it on their shelves. So kind of, it's what we're working towards, but it's hard when you get no's constantly. You can only wonder if it's to do with not just the content of that scene, but the content of the whole film. I mean, our ethos and my whole idea when I wrote the film was to wake people up. I feel that there's lots of people in the truth and reason, for want of a better word, or debunkers that know about these things. And like I said, I'm no expert, but there are people out there that don't know anything about them. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to create a drama film rather than a documentary, because I think people will sit down and watch a drama without really knowing necessarily the ideas behind it all. And maybe, just maybe, fingers crossed, they'll watch it and go, I don't quite agree with that. And then they'll use technology, or they'll read a book, or they'll go to a group and talk to people, much like the journey of Dion, the main character in the film. So kind of that's our hope. But I kind of went off topic there. I don't know, it's a short answer. I don't know why it hasn't been picked up. It is Rick's last major film, and no UK TV channels picked it up yet. I don't know is the answer.
Did you actually have conversations with Rick about 9/11 and about the war on terror?
Well, we had conversations about the script, obviously, and the story and kind of the content of it. And he was, although he never directly said one way or the other what he believed on it, to me personally, he did say that there was kind of things weren't quite right. I mean, we all know Rick to be kind of a bit of an anarchist. I mean, you just got to look at the young ones for that sort of thing. So knowing Rick from doing the film, he wouldn't have done it if he didn't believe in it. Just because like, he said to me, he used to get 100 scripts a week, and he would pick the ones he wanted to do, and my script spoke to him. So that has to say something, I think.
Yeah, I mean, also, of course, there's another film, the title slips my memory at the moment, which is out on general release, which is all about a terrorist attack on London, isn't there?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that, I'm afraid.
Yes, Martin, can we have a little bit of collective knowledge on this? Because there is, I think it's even number one at the moment in the cinemas.
Well, I'm not sure I even know which one you're talking about.
Oh, is it the London Has Fallen one that's kind of...
That sounds like it, yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of films in Hollywood that kind of start dealing with the war on terror or conspiracy theories. I mean, you just got to look at Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that, but the first 10 minutes of that are brilliant, and then they just Hollywoodize it. So, I mean... I think filmmakers do try to put it in their films, but I've made that statement, but it's a very sweeping one because I can't speak for other filmmakers.
How do people get hold of your film then, Jesse? If we can't see it on the telly, are we going to have to get a DVD, or can you get it on Netflix or something like that, or one of these online services?
It's not an online service. We did a 2-month online service to see what the audience was going to be like, and actually it went quite well. So we then have decided, in fact, on Monday to do a crowdfunding campaign, because lots of the funds for the film were raised through crowdfunding and friends giving their hard-earned money to make this film possible. So we've started a crowdfunding campaign for a pre-order of DVDs. We started that, what day are we on? No, we started that on Wednesday, and we're already at 71%. So people can order a DVD there. It's £10 plus postage and packing, so it's kind of £2 to the UK, £5 to Europe, or £5 worldwide. I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, you can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/1by1themovie, and there's links all over there about pre-ordering your DVD.
So have you got your own sort of dedicated website for the film?
We have got a website, yeah, 1by1themovie.co.uk.
Also, Martin, it does make me think this about the wider film industry. I love old documentaries, and I was watching World in Action DVD Volume 4 of loads of old World in Action films. I sit and watch them, and there's nothing on the TV, which is most nights. I sit and watch one of those. And there was a fascinating one from the 70s about the death of the British film industry. And you do kind of wonder, don't you, the extent to which money kind of now is deciding which films get made and which films don't, on the basis of if the people with the money, if it fits their narrative and if it fits their agenda. So effectively, living in a kind of vast propaganda world when we go to the cinemas.
Well, indeed, I think the people behind this film are to be congratulated, because obviously these are extremely difficult topics. I've obviously not seen the film, and I think it's a great coup to have somebody like Rick Mayall work with you on the film. And it does seem incredibly suspicious when Rick Mayall, after his sad demise, is all over the media and everybody was remembering him, that the fact that he'd made this film wasn't mentioned. And you would have thought that somebody would have picked that up and said, well, this has got to be a commercially viable things for us to pick up. And it does make you wonder, I mean, let's face it, if they did carry out 9/11 and it was an inside job, the people behind that are not going to be sitting on their hands allowing films to be made about it and allowing them to be distributed. That's the kind of people they would be, isn't it?
Okay, final word with you then, Diane Jesse Miller. Give us the best way to get hold of you, get hold of your film, and to watch it online, and I suppose to pay for it, because of course you are still in debt, having made this film several years ago.
Yes, I'm still trying to recoup the cost the money that was so graciously bestowed upon me to make the film. So that's what I mean. Selling 2,000 DVDs would mean that we'd break even, which would be amazing, because all the cast and crew pretty much worked for free on this because they believed in it. So, I mean, the best way to get hold of myself or the film or anything to do with it is Facebook. We're on there 24/7 pretty much. So if you go to facebook.com/1by1themovie, all in words, no numbers, then you can like the page, send us a message. There's information on there about pre-ordering the DVD and stuff like that. So, and if anyone's got any questions or concerns, then you can just drop us a Facebook message and we'll get back to them as soon as we can.
Well, that's, I think it's very commendable what you've done. And, of course, eventually what may happen if we can get over the first hurdles is that this becomes an underground classic, the sort of thing.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Well, wouldn't it be? Nice. Wouldn't it be? Because, I mean, that's the way you go around this kind of blockage. Eventually people go, have you seen this? And you get viral marketing, far better than the mainstream stuff.
Well, I'm sure it would have been very easy. It would have been easy for Diane to put it on YouTube and lots of people would watch it, but then it actually she wouldn't have actually been able to make a commercial success. And if she does, then of course she can maybe make another film.
Well,
in a way, Martin has made the most important point of the evening, I think. Sorry, Diane, but is that in any kind of normal real world, anybody should look at this and think, wow, this is an absolute money spinner because Rick has just died. I mean, it sounds cynical, but this is what music industry, the entertainment industry does all the time. What do you put it down to? Why haven't they done it, Diana?
I don't know. I literally don't know. And I mean, I do hope that people get to watch it. And like you said about the money, I mean, I'm not looking to make money from it. If I was looking to make money from it, I would have got out years ago. It's about getting the film out there to people. And the reason we want people to pay for things like this is so that other films can get made. I mean, all those people that invested their money into this project won't give it again unless they get it back, if that makes sense. So it's that kind of thing that... That's why you want people to buy it and not just stick it on YouTube or anything like that. So I know there's still going to be people that don't agree necessarily with my standpoint on that, but I hope they can understand where I'm coming from.
I think it's a great subject you're dealing with as well, because these sorts of issues can even sort of split families up, can't they? Some people are so divided about this that they say, right, goodbye, I'm not talking to you again, and that's it. Families, couples, and this is something that we're not really getting through the mainstream media at all, this understanding that the way that the war on terror and the sort of post-2001 paradigm can affect the way we live our lives.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I repeat again, well done for what you've done so far. I perfectly understand why you don't want it to be just banged up on YouTube. And if you can break the barrier with what you're doing now, eventually it could be an underground classic which will overwhelm the mainstream, because that's what ultimately happens. I'd love to see it. You might be able to want to, presumably people can see clips of it at some point, because we used a clip earlier. We need to get people out there who are already on the programme to get this out there, so that people who are not on the programme can be exposed to it.
Was Vinny down in Shepton Mallet had actually bought a copy and then filmed a crucial bit from it on his phone off the TV and then put that onto YouTube. So you don't mind about things like that, do you, Diane?
No, I don't want the whole film going up. I mean,
that's unreasonable.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there is such a thing as a fair usage, and I totally understand that. Yeah, it's more the whole film. And, I mean, we've got three trailers up online that we've made to kind of get people's appetite. And, I mean, if you go to I've got my own website, dianejessiemiller.co.uk. I've got two scenes from the film in my showreel. One about the DVLA and Northwell Rebellion, which not many people have seen, so come check that one out. I want people to see it. That's why I made it. I didn't make a film to sit it in a box and not let the world see it. I mean, the work in it, the storylines in it and the theories, although, like I said, I'm not an expert, there's things that need to get out there, and I want to start a debate. That's why I made this film, and I think
it's also fair to say that Rick wanted to get that debate started, and so we're hopefully being part of that right now. So it's one by one, the movie. .co.uk. I would recommend that rather than Facebook, even though you said you're on there 24 hours, 24/7, you never get any sleep.
Along with the CIA.
Absolutely.
And so more power to your elbow, Diane. And
Thank you very much,
thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show today.
Thank you very much. Take care, and I'll speak to you again.
The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, let's move on now to look at some of our other topics this evening. And I suppose the first one that comes to mind is this business of the deal done at the beginning of the week with between the Turks and Angela Merkel for the European Union. At the beginning of the day, on Monday I think it was, I heard a figure of €3 billion, which the Turkish government are going to get around taxpayers' money, in exchange for several tens of thousands of migrants being swapped. Now, the migrants, some and refugees coming from Turkey to Greece, and an equal number going back from Greece to Turkey. I couldn't understand, really, why €3 billion of our money should go for something like that. And then later in the day, I hear it's going to be €6 billion.
Well, I mean, all sorts of ordure is hitting the fan at this moment, isn't it? I mean, the fact is, if people have a legitimate reason to seek asylum inside the European Union, and they've got a legitimate reason, and therefore you've got no reason to turn them back. And if they haven't got a legitimate reason, then they haven't got a legitimate reason. But of course, what's happening here is the politicisation of the refugee flow from Turkish territory. Now, at the beginning of the war, which Turkey was a very important role in starting the war in Syria, although the British intelligence services clearly played a hand, as did the Americans, the Saudis, etc., they were quite keen to have refugees cross the border from Syria into Turkey, because in those refugee camps they were recruiting the militants who were then being armed and trained and sent back over the border to fight the Syrian army. And of course, British military personnel were probably working with their Turkish NATO counterparts on that mission. But of course, what then happened at a certain stage is that the Turks encouraged people in the refugee camps in Turkey, because most people around the world, when they flee across a border, flee across the most immediate border. There are more people internally displaced inside Syria than have left Syria. Most of them have fled to government-controlled areas. Government controls about 80% of the population now, because people have fled from the rebel-controlled areas into government-controlled areas to escape from the rebels.
But what we're really talking about here is Turkey, isn't it? And yeah. There's already been questions about this deal with Merkel, because with people saying, well, actually, you can't send people from Greece back to Turkey, because there is Turkey's got such an appalling human rights record, it would be illegal to do so. It would actually be a criminal act to send someone to that sort of regime.
Law. I mean, if somebody's got a legitimate reason for seeking asylum in Greece, you've got no right to send them back to Turkey.
So what was Merkel thinking of doing this deal? I mean, there was talk about it being blackmail.
What's going on here is that Erdogan has basically, his gamble that he could overthrow Assad with the support of Saudi Arabia and the Western intelligence services through ISIS and Daesh and the other Al-Nusra Front and the other groups within Turkey, within Syria that they've been supporting, and bringing in loads of jihadi fighters from Libya, for example, like Abdul Hakim Belhaj, head of the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, which we mentioned earlier, who ends up being the Free Syrian Army. The Turks are now, their gamble has failed. Assad is pretty firmly in charge of most of the population of Syria. And
so
now,
how are they in the position to demand 6 billion of our euros from Angela Merkel?
Because they can say, well, we're going to kick all these refugees out and you can deal with it. And of course, Greece and Turkey have got a pretty bad relationship anyway. So from Turkey's point of view, sending a load of refugees to Greece to put pressure on the Greek government that they don't like anyway, even though they're both supposedly members of NATO, it's basically part of Turkey's asserting itself and chucking its weight around. And of course, the Turks are in a position to push refugees towards Western Europe unless they are bribed not to. And that's what this is. It's a big bribe to Erdogan not to push the refugees towards the European Union. Now, of course, he's also fighting a war against his own Kurdish population inside Turkey. Hundreds of people are being killed in the last few weeks, mostly civilians, by airstrikes, incidentally, against so-called terrorist targets inside Turkey, inside Iraq. And they're shelling over the border, the Kurdish militias on the other side of the border. In other words, the war in Syria is spreading to Turkey. The war in Turkey is spreading to the European Union, and we're all going to war because we like war, don't we? That's why we invaded Iraq in 2003, because we wanted a war. And that war isn't over. It's hardly started, as we said at the time.
Yes, all this talk. I was listening to Min Campbell on the way in today, around about 4:30 on 5 Live, saying, oh, it was all unintended consequences. I don't believe a word of it being unintended consequences. I think that everybody, most people in the country, I think 3 million marched in London, didn't they, to say, don't do this. Most of the country knew. The politicians seemed didn't have a clue. Anyway, you're talking about Turkish terrorists there and the Turkish government attacking them. One bunch of terrorists,
run
a newspaper, apparently, according to Erdogan. And just as a close of play, as we were closing our show this time last week, so a whole bunch of riot police turned up at the today's Zaman newspaper. newspaper, which is the biggest newspaper in Turkey, just so happens to have been digging an immense amount of dirt on the present government, on Erdogan, and particularly on his son Bilal.
Well, indeed. I mean, the two stories which they pursued, which are most interesting, is that they uncovered that Libyan sarin was being smuggled into Syria by the Turkish
intelligence services, precursors to the nerve gas.
In order to carry out the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, which was then blamed on Assad
in 2013.
Yes,
this was all
covered by Seymour Hersh, the investigative journalist from the US, in the London Review of Books, because the New York Review of Books wouldn't publish his work, even though he's a very well established journalist. And the other thing that they covered was that Turkish police officers, civilian police officers, stopped a convoy of weaponry going into Syria, packed with weaponry, and the people who were driving the trucks were all working for MIT, the Turkish intelligence services. They arrested the people concerned, but now what's happened is the police officers who carried out that raid, which basically showed that that ISIS was being supported by NATO, by Turkey, they have been put on trial for treason, and the journalists who covered the whole thing are also being put on trial for treason, and they used to work for Zaman, which is this opposition newspaper, which Erdogan has now tried to close down.
Anyway, yesterday evening I managed to get hold of the executive editor of the English language edition of today's Zaman, and I think if you wanted to look at some of those stories, they may still just about be on the one of the caches, the Google cache or Yahoo caches, because one of the first things that the Erdogan government and the police did when they arrived at the building and took over the building last Friday night was to start removing the archive. I mean, their digital archive is one of the most important, useful pieces of information there is on the Middle East.
Well, you've got to ask, why are they attacking these people now? And it's because, of course, they have basically broken the story that NATO is the supporter of the supplier of ISIS, and also probably NATO intelligence services were implicated in the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, which Obama said was a red line and that the world would have to do something about it. What if it turns out that NATO were behind the killing of those hundreds of people?
So the story...
The world's got to do something about it. What are we going to do?
The story, it really starts last Friday night with Erdogan, but it ends with our own government.
Indeed, because of course they are part of the integrated structure of NATO's military command, and we are implicated in the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta. Not we, the British people, through our political representatives who supposedly control our armed forces and security services.
So anyway, let's have a listen now to today's Zaman's English executive editor, Sevgey Akalsami, and I spoke to her last night.
Last Friday, the Turkish government seized the largest newspaper of Turkey, Zaman, which includes an English daily. The allegation is aiding terrorist organizations and being a part of the terrorist propaganda. I completely deny such nonsense arguments. No printing house, no print institution or media institution could be seized by the government. So currently the government violating the constitution. There is not a single evidence of terrorist links of our newspaper. This is a completely politically motivated move to silence all critical voices. And Erdogan has been using terrorism charges to silence opponents and critics. Let me clarify, Erdogan is actually not the head of the government, but the head of the state. He's supposed to be an impartial president, but he acts as if he is the head of the governing party, AKP. And he has been acting on behalf of them. And there is a puppet government which only follows orders of Erdogan. So effectively, Erdogan is the only person that rules Turkey. There's a one-man rule at the moment. It's true that they have significant popular support. Why do they have popular support, you might ask? Thanks to the huge media machine that the government has established over the years, directly and indirectly, the government owns or controls most of the TV stations and newspapers, plus people who benefit from the welfare state that Erdogan introduced in the country for the first time. People care about their economic well-being and do not care about freedoms and violation of human rights. Having this popular support behind him, Erdogan thinks that he is able to do whatever he wants. And the Western world also turns a blind eye to whatever is going on, to whatever he is doing, to silent critics. The government wants to hide anything about corruption investigation. Even before destroying the digital archives, they were sending court orders to our newspapers to remove anything about the massive corruption investigation that implicates Erdogan and his family. So another story that they removed recently after they took over the newspaper was relevant to the witch hunt against the business people. The government has been suppressing business people, academics, journalists have been arbitrarily detained or arrested. And when we wanted to run such a story for Monday, for our Monday issue, the new administration removed it, replaced it with something else. They have been scared of anybody who would like to talk about corruption and violation of rule of law in the country. There are certain allegations regarding possible alleged links of Turkish authorities with the ISIL and their oil trade.
So what's it like as a journalist finding suddenly that you can't write what you want to write?
I felt during the police raid, I felt as if I was being raped, to be honest, because they forcefully entered my workplace. Even though I am one of the executives leading today's amount, the police physically obstructed me from our executive floor, from our buildings. They forced me out. One of them grabbed my cell phone and stopped my broadcast on Periscope, for instance. So it was pretty brutal, pretty shameful. I was embarrassed on behalf of my country. It's such a shame. And they have changed my life almost overnight. It's like a trauma. And most of us will be unemployed soon. Nearly 2,000 journalists are expecting to be unemployed, and more importantly, maybe they also took over the largest privacy that has a reputation for monitoring the elections in Turkey. Right now, with the seizure of that news agency, it's only the state news agency that is going to that is covered. So if government tends, seems to have 90% of the votes, we cannot against it. We cannot argue anything against it based on conflicting results from any other source. So that's pretty alarming for Turkish democracy.
What do you think this means for the Middle East? Because Turkey is such an important player in that part of the world.
Good question. Actually, everybody overlooked this part in my interviews. Everybody asked what this means for the EU, etc. For the Middle East, I think it's a huge disappointment because Turkey was a shining star a decade ago. It was a source of inspiration in many Muslim societies because AKP, at least in the beginning, showed that democracy and Islam could reconcile, could coexist, are compatible. And that's one of the reasons I supported this government as well. I just thought, see, political Islam is could turn into, real Democrats. But unfortunately, they have been disappointing me along with everybody else. People are losing faith in the belief that a Muslim elected religious government could also be democratic, and that's so shameful because I think it is the only Muslim democratic country in the region. Turkey lost its chances to sort of glow and be the poster child of the Middle East.
That's Sevgey Arkasemi, and probably pronounced that wrong, but anyway, she's the executive editor of the English edition of today's Zaman, which was stormed by the Turkish police, the Turkish government of Erdogan, and the AKP party this time last Friday. Martin, it's, is immensely important, isn't it, what happened? Because as she pointed out there, they've not only closed down this investigative journalism that's been going on into the president, they've also, in one fell swoop, also destroyed this organisation which provided independent monitoring of elections in Turkey.
Yeah, I think that's right. And as I said before the clip, why has this happened and why now? And I think it's because the cat's out of the bag. What Zaman were doing was incredibly important, which was exposing the Turkish government's role in supporting ISIS through buying their oil and selling it on mainly to the Israelis. Of course, Bilal Erdogan, the son of the president, being very much implicated in that.
Well, he was in exile for a while over in Italy because it was too hot for him in Turkey.
Well, in actual...
Now, apparently, he's just coming back.
Well, in the magistrates in Bologna want to extradite him, in fact, for various criminal offences in Italy. Now, in other words, they're exposing the general corruption around the Erdogan regime, but the two things which were really significant that they'd managed to expose was A, NATO's role in supplying the sarin for the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, which means that we are implicated in that attack, and the other, of course, is that the ISIS were being supplied with weaponry by MIT, the Turkish intelligence.
What Erdogan has done here is use the judicial process, which does rather suggest that maybe like places like Egypt, that in Turkey the judiciary is itself totally corrupt.
I think the fact that the Turkish police initially raided the convoy taking weaponry to ISIS shows that there is actually a struggle for a rule of law in Turkey, as there is elsewhere in the world. And I don't think Turkey's a particularly corrupt place compared to other Western countries.
It also shows how important the mainstream media is. And if you haven't got a mainstream media that can ask questions, as Michael Crick did this week about the Conservative government defrauding election expenses, you don't have a democracy.
Well, you don't. And, of course, Erdogan would still probably have... Erdogan's got significant political support in Turkey. He's got virtually no political support in the Kurdish regions of Turkey. That would be very similar, for example, to the Serbian government having plenty of support in Belgrade and no support in Pristina in Kosovo,
I suppose,
for example.
The other side of this is, you know, the extent to which... I mean, we were talking about the BBC earlier. Mainstream media actually is in, you know, runs things because it decides which issues get aired and which don't.
It does, but I think it's not just up
which
to...
Which people get a voice and who doesn't?
Well, I think it's important that everybody gets a voice through the mainstream media or not, but the more mainstream the media is that puts forward serious allegations, the more seriously they are taken. But it may well be, you see, that Erdogan closing down Zaman means that people are asking the question, well, why is he closing them down? And I think it's very important that we are making it clear why he's closing them down. It's not just because they're mildly critical of him, it's because they're pointing the finger at him for A, supporting ISIS militarily, and B, supporting them financially, and that the evidence is piling up. Now, Erdogan is part of NATO. He works with British intelligence services, because we're all on the same side in the war in Syria. So we're also implicated in this. It's not just a matter for the Turks.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com.
And leave comments about your favourite programmes.
BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
And another item I said at the top of the hour, Martin, two big anniversaries of great British cover-ups. 30 years since the 1986 assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. So what do you make of that? I know that we were discussing, I think it was last week, wasn't it, about the use of the Royal Navy to destabilise Sweden. And actually, do you think Sweden really is neutral, as we're told?
Well, there's been a documentary that's came out on Arte TV, which is a French-German mainstream TV channel recently. And the allegations in that documentary were, firstly, that Olof Palme, Sweden was supposedly independent, Olof Palme was supposedly neutral. Olof Palme was a social democrat leader of Sweden with a relatively, you know, anti-Cold War views. And when he came to power, what the documentary alleges is that then immediately what seemed to be happening is that Russian submarines were infiltrating Swedish territorial waters, and Olof Palme was put on the defensive. His own navy, the allegation in the film, that his own navy was actually working with the Americans and the Royal Navy to fake Russian submarine penetration of the Swedish territorial waters. So the Royal Navy were implicated in this. So when we're talking about linkages and so on, that means that your taxes, dear listeners, were being used to undermine and overthrow a democratically elected government in a friendly country.
It all came at a very crucial stage with what was going on in the Soviet Union, didn't it? And the fall of the Berlin Wall.
It did, because Gorbachev was coming to power. Palmer was going to meet with Gorbachev, but he never got there because he was assassinated. And the implication is that NATO intelligence services, probably through the Gladio networks, had Palmer assassinated. And of course, the fact that the Royal Navy and the Americans were using their submarines as a means of trying to destabilize him before they assassinated him definitely puts them in the frame for the assassination. Now, that's the real world we live in. And eventually, of course, a documentary is made, a serious documentary, which is shown late at night on TV in France and Germany. But, of course, it's not the sort of thing you're going to hear at the top of the hour on the Murdoch News at 6 or 7 when we go off air. But the fact is, it's out there. The stuff's all out there. And all you need to do is get on a computer and you can chase it down for yourself, folks, which is what this show's all about.
Well, we can also help you out by putting some links from our show page on thisweek.org.uk. On to the Dunblane murders, Martin. This was 20 years ago up in Scotland. One of the main things that fascinated me about looking into this was that the there was a very accusation from one of the top Freemasons in Scotland that the guy was a paedophile, and that also that he'd received some sort of Masonic protection. That there was actually people in the police who were protecting him, and although that the official advice was that he should have his guns taken away because he was unstable and he was also possibly procuring pictures of young boys as part of a paedophile ring, that he should be allowed to keep his gun.
Well, I understand that George Robertson, the former head of NATO, was in the same Freemasons lodge with this fellow, and had signed the firearm certificate, that character reference, which allowed him to get a shotgun, which is then, of course, he then used to kill all of those children and their teacher.
Well, there's a journalist called Marcello Mega who wrote an article about this in December 2003, and he said a top Scottish Freemason, former Grand Master Lord Burton, said that Lord Cullen's inquiry into the Dunblane massacre was an enormous cover-up, that these high-profile legal figures belonged to a secretive super-Masonic group called the Speculative Society. Anyway, it certainly doesn't look as if real people who were responsible for this, because he certainly wasn't just acting on his own, he had some form of establishment protection, will ever be brought to book.
Well, the suspicion has to be, the copper's hunch, because obviously I haven't carried out an investigation of this, is that NATO intelligence services, don't forget Robertson ends up as the head of NATO, and it might be very handy for certain people, for the head of NATO, to be compromised by having paedophile connections. And I think that's the real iceberg underlying all of this VI paedophilia. The intelligence services, NATO intelligence services, the ones we've been accusing of fomenting terrorism in earlier parts of this show, have also used paedophilia as a means of blackmail. So what you do, what the suggestion is that this fellow was running, he had a boat on the Loch Lomond, he was taking senior politicians there to have sex with underage boys, all of which was being filmed by the CIA. And of course that then means that those politicians will do as they are told when they become, for example, head of NATO.
And also, of course, if any of these top politicians are closely associated with a known paedophile, that means they're easier to blackmail.
Well, indeed, and that's the point, is this isn't just random. It's not just that psychopaths at the top of the social hierarchy like having sex with underage boys and girls. It's also a strategy to dirty them all up and make sure they do as they're told. And that's what was behind the De Trou affair in Belgium. And I think that that's what we'll find is at the bottom of the VIP paedophilia scandals in this country.
Don't think we'll have time for John Lennon, I'm afraid. But before we go, the £200 million that Winston Churchill managed to procure for the atom bomb at the end of the Second World War. I spoke to the author of Churchill's Bomb on our dialect show, dialectradio.co.uk, earlier this week. That's Graham Farmelow, who wrote the book Churchill's Bomb, about this mystery money that appeared for Churchill to make the bomb with, even though the money didn't come through Parliament. this will be a revelation for many people that the British atomic bomb, which emerged in the early 50s, was developed with money from outside somehow. They went round Parliament.
Well, it was 100 million by the time Churchill, just over 100 million by the time he became Prime Minister, which was October 51. So if please don't quote me, but it would there will be the exact figure somewhere, but my rough guess would be something like 200 million. It would be billions of pounds.
In today's money, actually, it would be around about 7 billion, Martin.
Well, yes, and the question is, where did he get it from? And if people want to find out that, they'll have to listen to future parts of future versions of this show. We do have our theories where that money came from, do we not?
Well, certainly, yes, from Martin Bormann, Nazi Indeed. Money that Churchill had been doing deals with. But there's also this allegation that Winston Churchill wanted a first strike on Moscow in 1950. I asked him about that too. This is Graham Farmelow, the author of Churchill's Bomb.
Yes, and I must say some Churchill experts did not believe me. I give two references in the book, and I found another one later, right? So I consider that, and I think most people, they accepted, actually, to be fair, they did back down. The correct way to put it is that Churchill, in private, urged a first strike on Moscow. That is correct, right? He did not do it in public, but he did in private.
What was the purpose of that? Why was he thinking like that? Surely you didn't want to start World War III just as soon as World War II had finished.
So that you could ask that question. His reasoning at the time was that that Russia was so dangerous that the only way to stop it taking over Eastern Europe, right, was to do something that would be a dramatic gestures, not the wrong word, but take a dramatic action. So there we are. Churchill's not here to defend himself. But he, as I said, we have clear evidence, right, that three times, as I say, to my certain knowledge, people heard him say, right, that we should attack Moscow straight up.
Graham Farmelow there, the author of Churchill's Bomb. You can hear the rest of that interview online at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Time to sign off now. The Murdoch News at 7, followed by Arabian Nights with Mohammed Mokhawi.
kpfa.org. It's 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for Project Censored.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Joining me today as co-host is a Project Censored professor, Nolan Higdon. He teaches Latin American history at the California State University, East Bay. Mickey Huff will return next week. On today's show, we interview Miguel Farga, first secretary of the Cuban Embassy in Washington, D.C., who will discuss the emerging issues of reestablishing diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba. We're going to ask him what it was like to grow up in a communist country. We hope you stay tuned. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. My co-host today is Nolan Hignett, teaches Latin American history at California State University, East Bay. Mickey will be back next week. On today's show, we're going to interview Miguel Farga, First Secretary of the Cuban Embassy. Here's Nolan to introduce him.
Miguel Fraga is the first secretary of the U.S. Embassy of Cuba. For the previous 4 years, he's worked in the office of the United States Division of Cuban Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Havana, Cuba. Before that, he served as third secretary in the Cuban Embassy in Canada. Fraga received a Bachelor of Science in Law at the University of Havana and a Master of Science in Foreign Relations from Higher Institute of Foreign Relations, Raul Garcia, in Havana. Fraga has been speaking this week in the San Francisco Bay Area addressing the question, has U.S. policy towards Cuba really changed? Welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
We love having you. So what can you tell us about what it was like to grow up in Cuba?
That's a very interesting question. I was born in 1979, so 37 years ago. And, you know, this is interesting for me because the society that I know is a society with equal opportunities for everybody. That is the first thing that you learn in Cuba, okay? It's not a matter of gender. It's not a matter of race. It's not a matter of wealthy. You know, it's only equal opportunities for everybody. So as a child, you go to the school that is in your neighborhood. You go to the hospital that you have in your neighborhood. You have equal opportunities. It's about social justice. You know, kids in Cuba don't know what is poverty, what is not to have the opportunity to study. They don't have to work. They only have to go to school, you know, to school. And this is what we have. So for us, it's rights. It's our right to go to the school. It's our right to go to have a good health care system. So that is how we grew up, you know. We don't have enough resources in Cuba to have all these things that, you know, another country's rich country have. But, for example, my first time with internet was in the university. And I was studying law at the time in the Havana University, and we were almost 1,000 students. And we have this, I believe, 30 computers with internet for 1,000 students. Imagine how difficult that was. But everybody had the opportunity to go and see what internet is, you know, for free. And some of us don't use the computer to do research, only to know more about the world, you know. And this is very interesting because I had the opportunity to travel here in the United States. I was in Alabama, I was in Michigan, also in Connecticut, Washington State, and now here in California. And everybody's asked to me, okay, are you ready for this new moment with the United States? And I say, are you going to change your culture? And I say, well, you know, we know all your movies, we see your TV series, we share a lot of our culture, and we don't change. And by the way, some people believe that now is a new moment, but we have relations with all the countries in the world. Right now, we reestablish the relation with the United States, but it's nothing, you know, because sometimes. And I believe this is very important, and for that reason I am here. There is not enough information about Cuba. People don't know what is the real Cuba, and because you are not able to travel to Cuba. Because remember, as American, you can go wherever you want, but in order to go to Cuba, you need a license. So we don't have enough Americans traveling to Cuba, and here, unfortunately, there is a lot of misinformation, but probably you know more about misinformation here than myself.
True. Yeah, I think that that's an interesting point you bring up there, because the narrative that we almost use a lot here in the United States is that we stopped holding normalized relations, as it were, in the 1960s. But before then, there was like this happy relationship, and Cuba and the U.S. got along. But I wanted to sort of point to that, because the U.S. Always has been intervening in Cuban affairs, both with before and after normalized relations. And knowing that history, how do the Cuban people feel about this? Do they actually see this as a change or another step in a long process of this what can only be described as a difficult relationship with the United States?
Well, I think this is a wonderful question. And I always say to people that ask me about that, you know what, if you go to Cuba right now, you're going to see that despite all the 50 years of embargo, all these 50 years of difference between Cuba and the United States. Cuban don't hate Americans. If you go there, you're welcome. Everybody's going to say, oh, wonderful. Are you from the United States? Where part are you from? People probably want to know about how is your baseball, Major League's baseball, how is what is happening with the Cuban players here. People want to know about your culture. And you're going to see that. There is not hate in Cuba because we know that one thing is the U.S. government and another thing is the American people, you know. We share a lot of sins between Cuba and the United States. And this is very interesting because some people believe that Cubans comes to the United States after 1959. And no. The tobacco factories were in Tampa since the 19th century. And our national hero comes to the United States, Jose Martí, comes to the United States in the 19th century to start the independence war against Spain. So there is a lot of history between our two countries. And again, this is what we are trying to talk with the people. We are trying to explain to people.
So you grew up in a society of general equality. Mm-hmm. And you weren't blasted with advertisements of buying things. This is one of the things that was most interesting to me when I was in Cuba the last two times was with the young people. I could kid with them and say, don't you want a Happy Meal? And they would know what I was talking about, but they would just laugh and laugh and laugh about how funny that was because that's not part of the culture. You're not blasted with these buy this, buy that. Do you see that making changes in that area, or will people, once they're that's in their personality, will that stay with them?
You know, as I explained before, we are a small country, 11 million of people, and we don't have enough resources. So our priorities are education and healthcare. According to the World Bank in 2010, we spend 12.8% of our GDP in education, only in education. According to the World Bank, at that time, 2010, that was the highest investment in education worldwide. We almost spend more or less the same in health. So we don't have any money for advertising. You know, that is not our priority. You know, people in Cuba knows what they have, and this is important because we don't want to create difference among people. You know, we want to try to have all the people with equal opportunities and in society that if you have more money, you go to the same store that the people that don't have all the money that you have. So it's the same store. You know, we don't want to create this difference among people because that is not what we want. And for example, right now we are giving more space to the private sector, but that private sector is only on those fields that we believe that is going to help to improve our economy. And we are going to improve that economy to have resources for having a better education system and a better health system. Because we don't want to privatize that, and we are not going to privatize that. And people in Cuba wants more, you know, because we are young. We know what all these good things you have, but we don't want that only a few people in Cuba can have that.
So people that come to Cuba and are go there to live, go there for education, go there for medical training, they're not charged.
No, all for free.
And so talk about, the Cuban input in terms of medical care, not only in Cuba, but worldwide.
Oh, yes, we have right now more than 50,000 doctors working in 68 countries. So we are talking about a lot of doctors, you know, a lot of healthcare workers. And this was very interesting because people don't know that when the Katrina hurricane hit the United States, we offered 1,000 doctors to come here in 2005. Some people say here, that is politics, you know. Unfortunately, after that, we have this earthquake in Pakistan, and we send those doctors to Pakistan because Pakistan asks for help. And by the way, it's because we believe in solidarity, you know. We sent 400 doctors to fight the Ebola epidemic in Africa, because the World Health Organization asked for help, and we sent those doctors there. And by the way, for the first time in many years, we worked together with the United States. United States provide the hospitals provide some resources and we provide the doctors. And probably we have the same opportunity right now in Haiti. You are going to provide the facilities, you are going to provide some resources, and we are going to provide the doctors. And this is very interesting. You know, I don't know why it's not in your project sensor, because probably we need to put more information about Cuba, because people don't know. And in the case of Haiti, I remember when the earthquake, the big earthquake, all the media was there. Okay, we are going to be here all the time that it's needed. And they start saying, okay, all the world is helping. All the countries are sending doctors and wherever. And we had a lot of doctors in Haiti in the before the hurricane, the earthquake, I'm sorry, the 10 years before the hurricane, the earthquake. And for that reason, we only need to send, I believe, 40 other doctors, because all the doctors were Cuban and were there working.
The year that that happened, it was in the Project Censored book.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to you keep mentioning about education and healthcare in Cuba, and I would be interested, I'm sure our listeners would as well. We've often been raised in the United States with these myths about this horrific education system in Cuba and horrific healthcare in Cuba. And I wonder if you could paint sort of like some picture of what does education look like in Cuba? What does healthcare look like in Cuba? And maybe use what you've seen here in the United States as a way to explain it.
Well, if you allow me, I want to say first that I don't come here to say that we are better than you. You know, that is a very important message that I want to stress here, because what I am trying to do is to explain that we have a lot of good things in Cuba that probably you don't know here, and we are ready to work with the United States for having more opportunities. And I believe that is good for both people. So I didn't come here to say you have to learn from us. I only came here to say, okay, we are ready to learn from you also. But about education, how can I explain that? You know, well, I had the opportunity to visit a lot of university here. And when you are in the room and you see all the computers, all the TV, all the technology that you have there, you say, okay, I don't have this in Cuba. Probably we still use chalk to write in our boards in Cuba, but nobody there has to pay anything, no for books, no for being here. There they graduate and they don't have any debt, because they don't have to pay, you know, for nothing there. So it's something very humble, very simple, and they have wonderful teachers, you know. And probably they pass the books from one year to another year, and sometimes the books are old, and everybody put their hands there, and you know, but the knowledge is there, and the teachers are there, and according to what I read in, you know, the Cuban professionals are very well respected. And this is because of the education that they have, you know, and this is part of the work of the revolution. But when you say revolution, people don't understand what is that. The revolution is what the majority of the Cuban people wants, you know. It's why we changed everything in 1959. And all this process is only because the majority of the people support that, you know. And now that we are doing changes in Cuba in the last year, people wants more, but people don't want to lose what they have.
So I certainly observed you speaking at Sonoma State University on Monday night, and the students there were like, oh, well, why can't we should have that here, too? I mean, why do we have to end up with a BA degree and $20,000 in debt? But to hear that, campuses are no cost, and people, the food, the books, everything is taken care of. At the universities. So, talk about how important and how different that is, really, from the rest of the world. I mean, is there anybody that's anywhere near as a society with that kind of educational support?
Well, I think that is very important in order to have a better society, you know. And about the food, about the accommodations, because at the beginning we had a few universities in Cuba, so people have to come, for example, from another province to Havana, and they didn't have to pay for the food, for the accommodations. Right now, what we're trying to do is to expand the universities. So we have universities almost in all our province, you know. All the careers that you can study without a lot of resources, you can have it in your own province, because some careers are expensive and you don't have the opportunity probably to put labs, expensive labs, in all places. But if you are studying, for example, law, and you only need a couple of books, a couple of codes, it's easy to send that to all the people, you know. So what we're trying to do is this is very important, you know, in Cuba, you have the opportunity to study. So if you don't go to the university, you are behind the society, you know, and you are encouraged to go to there because everybody has a degree, you know. So it's a very competitive society with a lot of knowledge there, and people have the opportunity to go there because they don't have to pay, you know, they don't have to worry about nothing. It's a normal transit, you know, all the way through the university. The only thing that you need is to be a good student.
So when it comes to these different provinces, the way they share these different education, how is that system organized? Like, how is there a Department of Education over here that oversees, how is it organized, the way these different provinces work together to decide which province?
We have a Ministry of Education and also a Ministry of Higher Education for the universities, and they are the authorities in all the country, but they have office in all province, and in the case that you have, for example, universities in some municipal term, that you have an office there that run, and you have a career, the program for your studies are approved in the ministry. And it's the same program for all the country. So the people who study in Havana or in Santiago has the same program. So it's equal opportunities. You know, you don't need to go to the Havana. Probably Havana University is the very well-known university in Havana, in Cuba, because that was our first university and was founded in 1728. But yes, of course, everybody wants to go there because all the history, you know. But you don't need to go there to have better education, because you have the same program, the same curriculum program in Santiago or in Guantanamo.
Okay, I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show. We're talking to Miguel Fraga, the first secretary of the Embassy of Cuba here in the United States, and we will continue our conversation after this short break.
Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Nolan Higdon. We're interviewing Miguel Fraga, first secretary of the embassy in Cuba in Washington, D.C., and he's been out visiting the Bay Area, speaking at a number of different colleges and that. Oftentimes, when Cuba is talked about in the corporate media, it's described as a communist dictatorship. Could you talk about that a little bit and about democracy and people's involvement in the government in Cuba?
Oh, yes. I think this is a wonderful opportunity, but probably I need more than 1 hour to explain all this because it's a lot of information. You know, if you want to talk about democracy, what we know about democracy is, okay, it's the power of the people. But if you go there, you need to see that it's the power of the majority of the people, because not all the people agree with power, you know. In every society, you have people that say, okay, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do that. So in Cuba, we believe that we have a democracy. The problem is that this is not a representative democracy, because we don't believe in that. So you don't need to be a member of the Communist Party to be part of our government. You don't need to be a member of the Communist Party to go to our national parliament. You only need to be elected as a member of that as a member of the parliament for the people that is in your district, you know? So it's not a matter that you are a member of the Communist Party. But the other issue is about dictatorship, about the, all the things that they say. We have 11 million of inhabitants right now. And we have a national parliament that had 612 members in our National Assembly. So we have more representation if you go to the numbers. You know, 11,600,000, because we grew up in our National Assembly at the same time that the population grew up. You know, so if we have more population, we have more members in our National Assembly. We have national general elections every 5 years to change the National Assembly, and the National Assembly at least have to have 50% of their members needs to be elected from people in your neighborhood. You know, you need to be first a representative of your neighborhood in order to be elected in our national assembly. And again, you need to have 50+1 percent of the vote, but that vote is a very low vote, because what we have right now is is members with, I don't know, 90% of the support in our elections, and we have this municipal elections every 2.5 years. So the general elections is every 5 years. And the other thing is, you don't have to spend money in a campaign, because if you are a person that your people wants to have as a candidate, the National Commission have to put the same resources on you and on in all the candidates, so you have the same opportunities that all the candidates. You know, it's not about your money, it's not about the people that support you, it's about that everybody has the same opportunity. So the biographies of all the candidates are in your neighborhood. It's only one page. Imagine that, the biography of our president, and near to him a biography of one student, one page for both, in black and white, because we don't have resources to put in color. So the same biography for our president, the same biography for a person that has been, a member of a minister, for example, and the same biography for one student, one worker, one woman that is a very well-known sport woman. So it's how that system works. You know, it's not mandatory to vote. It's not mandatory to vote, but the idea that we have more than 90% of people that vote is a proof that people support the system. Because if you don't have to vote and you go to vote, it's because you care about that. You know, so our constitution is from 1976 and was a constitution that was approved in the referendum, you know, popular referendum. We made reform in 1992. And after that, in 2002, we made another reform, and we made another kind of referendum, trying to prove that we have the support of the people. So it's a different system. We don't believe that you need money to be elected. We don't believe that this is a matter of parties. Our party, the Communist Party in Cuba, is not part of the electoral process. You know, and this is very important for us. You don't need to be a member of the Communist Party to go to all the positions in the government in Cuba.
It's interesting, hearing you talk about constitutions and these referendums that change the national government in Cuba. So in a place like, you know, the United States, you know, we treat our first draft of the Constitution as if it's like holy. It's like barely ever touched. It doesn't change with the times. But speaking on that topic, the United States has had some undue influence on the constitutional process in Cuba, especially in the first half of the 20th century. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about an issue that's come back in the news here in the States, and I think is probably always an issue in Cuba, which is the Guantanamo Bay lease. That is how the United States got access to that land, how they keep that access to that land, and what it means for the Cuban people.
Well, we need to go back to 1898 when the Spanish-American War. And this is very interesting for a Cuban, you know, because in Cuba we don't call it American-Spanish War. We call it American-Cuban Spanish word, you know? And probably the real is that it's Spanish, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Philippines, American war. So it's because everybody was there, you know? But after that, only United States and Spain went to Paris to sign the treaty. And after that, United States occupied the Cuba, occupied Cuba. And the occupation started in January 1st, 1899. And when the first Cubans were trying to wrote a constitution, our first constitution was writing under an American occupation. And the governor of the island at that time called the people that was writing the constitution and said to him, okay, if you want a republic, you need to adopt the constitution with this document that comes from the Senate in the United States. It's that Platt Amendment. And according to that Platt Amendment, you have full control of Cuba. And you have the opportunities to sign all the treatment that you want between our two countries. And we only have to say, yes, we only need to sign this. So it was a split decision, but the majority of people support, okay, let's have a republic, and after that, we can deal with the Platt Amendment. Unfortunately, after that, we have this agreement in 1934 that was signed between Cuba and the United States in order to put an end to the Platt Amendment. But in that agreement in 1934, you get Guantanamo forever, perpetuity. And right now it's a lease. You have all the control of the base, but it's our land. According either to those treaties, it's our land. But you have the control forever, unless you say, okay, I don't want to be there in Guantanamo. And this is very important, and people don't know, because people heard what President Obama is saying right now. And President Obama is only saying that he's going to close the prison. He's not talking about the base. Mm-hmm. He's not talking about that. And people that talk with us say, we don't need that base. Probably in the 19th century, in the 20th century, we need that, you know. But right now, it's not as a strategic base. And again, we want that. Probably you know now how much do you pay for the base. This is not about money, but you pay $4,000 per year, $4,085 per year for a lot of land, you know. So it's not a fair treatment in any sense, and we want that territory back.
Why is it, why is it you think that the United States wants to hang on to Guantanamo Bay?
I don't know. Probably that is part of the Cold War idea. The Cold War moment when after the revolution you had this base there and you want to be there in order to be sure that you have in control. And again, in the 19th century, in the 20th century, that was a strategic position. But right now, 90 miles away from Cuba, you don't need that base anymore. And as a matter of fact, according to the BBC, it's costing you a lot of money, you know, to run that that base every year. Not in the lease, but just all the money that you have to pay for the base in order to sustain the base.
Oh yeah, yeah, our defense spending for sure. Are you hopeful that this, you know, recent attempt at changing the relations between Cuba and the United States could result in a like robust discussion about returning this land to the people of Cuba?
Well, let me say this, because people is asking about what is happening right now. People are under the impression that everything is going wonderful between Cuba and the United States. We restored the diplomatic relations, and what December the 17th, 2014 proved is that you only need will, you know? If you are ready, if you have the will, we can discuss all our difference with respect as states, you know, that we are. With all the respect, we can discuss all our difference, and that start on December 17, 2014. But the real issue is that embargo is there. Guantanamo is there. And those are concerns that we have. We need to put an end to the embargo. The embargo is hurting our people, and as a matter of fact, it's the main obstacle to our economic development, and it's the main obstacle to have normal relations, economic relations between Cuba and United States. It's the same with Guantanamo. It's our territory. So in order to have normal relations, we need to see the end of the embargo. We need to see that Guantanamo is back into Cuba. And so those are our priorities.
The embargo impacts you in a lot of ways. And certainly one way was that's one of the reasons you only have 30 computers at the university for the law school. There's no cable from, it could be easy to have a cable hooked to the internet from the U.S., and that's been banned. And so I think Venezuela was going to help with one at one point. I don't know if that happened, but those kinds of barriers seem to have been extremely important. And plus, Cuba imports a good deal of food. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. What impact would that have here in the U.S. if they could buy food directly?
Well, about this specific, I can tell you that we buy, according to the United Nations, we buy between 70-80% of our food abroad. We are talking about $2 billion every year. Unfortunately, by law, it's prohibited to give credit to Cuba in the agricultural sector. So in other sectors, it's okay, but in the agricultural sector, it's prohibited by law to concede credit to Cuba. And for that reason, it's more easy to us to buy things in other countries and not here in the United States. For that reason, last year, we only buy here $300 million. But we buy in other countries $1.8 billion of dollars. So you're losing money because your farmers want to sell products to Cuba, but we don't have credit here is not a good deal for us, but if we had the opportunity to have credit and the farmers wants to give credit to Cuba, we are going to buy more things here because we are neighbors. From the Mobile port is 36 hours to Cuba. Imagine that. So 1.5 days in order to have the products to Cuba. And about what you mentioned before about the telecommunication sector, it's the truth. We didn't have the opportunity before to have this connection with a cable, and all cables around Cuba, you know, all the cables that comes to the United States or from the United States to Latin America surround Cuba, and we didn't have the opportunity to connect to those cables. Right now, for the first time, we have the cable, and right now, for the first time, we have Wi-Fi connection in public spot in Cuba because we don't have the technology, we don't have the infrastructure to put internet in our house. It's too expensive. And we don't want to create difference because probably some people can pay for that, but the idea is to put access to all people possible. So if we put this Wi-Fi spot in all the province, in public space, so you can go with your smartphone, and you are going to see a lot of people connected to internet. Some of them only to see Facebook, only to see, you know, the news. But it's interesting. And right now it's expensive. I have to say that it's expensive for the Cuban population. But the real issue is that people have access. You know, it's nothing restricted. That sometimes you hear you read that in the media. The Cuban government don't want to allow access to the Cuban. That is not true.
You brought up the idea of media, and certainly one of the mythologies about Cuba that's perpetrated in the U.S. corporate media is that it's all tightly controlled, that it's top-down, it's propaganda. And you have some 50 community radio stations that are run locally, let alone independence in terms of media. You have access to the global media, yet the U.S. won't let Cuban reporters into the United States. So this has been a very hypocritical statements around that. But talk about the freedom of the media and the press.
You know, the most important thing that you have right now is that we are in the 21st century. So everybody can have, everybody with access to internet is a media person, you know, because you have your Twitter accounts, you have your Facebook page, and you can publish whatever you want. So, and that is happening in Cuba right now. You have people that has blogs, and you can read those blogs on the internet, and you are going to see what the people believe about all these things. And also, we have this community media that is the main idea is to try to produce the news of that community base, you know. And so, it's something that is very, very funny when you say, okay, you don't have freedom of press in Cuba, and everybody can see CNN on the internet, can read all the newspapers. And the real issue is sometimes that people understand that what they say is not true. You know, it's not the real Cuban. Sometimes say, okay, why they don't come and do real work?
Right, right, exactly. And they, of course, can see Telesur and other sources from all over the world, which makes it pretty wide open. So Obama's going to visit Cuba on March 21st.
Yes.
What impacts will that have? What are you really anticipating there?
Well, as you probably remember, the other day at university, I mentioned that the last president that visited Cuba was in 1928. So I always ask, is somebody here from that moment, from that year? I only found one woman, by the way, that was born in 1926, so she can't remember, but in any case, she was alive. But this is interesting, you know, what we said is President Obama is welcome in Cuba. We are going to treat President Obama with all the respect and consideration of the position that he has. He is the President of the United States. And so he's welcome in Cuba. And this is another proof that the only thing that you need is will. You know, because you can read in some president's memoirs, okay, I was ready to improve the relations, I want to have this, I want to that, but this is the real person that start with a clear position. And I like very much what President Obama said in the last speech of the Union this year in January. He clearly said, the Cold War is over, leave the embargo. So that is what he wants. And this is very important because people don't understand wants the embargo, but the real issue is that all polls shows that the majority of Americans don't want the embargo. The majority of the Cuban American population don't want the embargo. It's what the United Nations General Assembly has been asking for the last 24 years. And last year we had 191 countries that asked to the United States, okay, you have to lift the embargo. So it's what your president wants. So why the embargo is still there?
I'm Nolan Higdon, and I'm in studio with Peter Phillips, and we are having a fascinating conversation with Miguel Fraga, the first secretary of the Embassy of Cuba in the United States, and we will return after this short break.
Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Nolan Higdon today. We're interviewing Miguel Fraga, who's the first secretary of the Cuban Embassy in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the impacts of reestablishing diplomatic relations with the U.S. and Cuba. And, Miguel, I'd like you to do a little history here. I mean, certainly for the first few decades of the revolution, after the revolution, the Soviet Union was very supportive. The Cuban Missile Crisis almost brought us to nuclear war. It was a terribly dangerous time. After the Soviet Union is disintegrates and there's no longer that kind of intense support for Cuba, there was a real push inside of Cuba that had to be some transformations. And there was, you know, the impact in terms of organic agriculture was really huge. I mean, you're now the number one country in terms of organic agriculture in the world. What was that period like? Can you describe that?
Well, let me start saying that, remember, 1959, we had to change everything because everything was made in USA. And in 1991, we have to change everything again because everything was made in the Soviet Union or the countries in the communist bloc. So we start over twice in 40 years. And this was an amazing experience, a very hard moment. And this is, I want to say this because I mention this all the time. I have the opportunity. At the beginning of the revolution, people say, okay, this is only 6 months. After 6 months, they're going to collapse. After that, they say, okay, it's because the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is there. Well, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, and we are still there. People say after that, okay, the problem is Fidel. Fidel is there after Fidel. Well, Fidel is no longer in power since 2006, so 10 years ago. And now people say, oh, the problem is Raul. I don't know why they're going to say after 2018, because it's people that don't want to recognize that it's a process that have the support of the majority of the Cuban people. So about agriculture, imagine when we lost 80% of our trade overnight because the Soviet Union collapsed. We lost all our credit. We lost all our supplies. We had blackouts. Eight hours per day. We didn't have transportation. We didn't have oil. We didn't have anything. And you say, how did you survive? Well, because that was what the Cuban population wants, you know. And we start working with our hands as the people at the beginning of the humanity, you know. We start working in our land. We start producing our own food. And, of course, because we didn't have pesticides, we didn't have oil and machinery, was a very healthy food. And that is what we want, because in order to have healthy people, you need healthy food. And now, as I mentioned before, we buy 70-80% of our food, so we don't produce enough. And this is not because we don't have land. This is not because we don't want to produce more food. The problem is that after you go to the university, and you are an engineer, a doctor, a lawyer, whatever, you don't want to go back to work in the land. So that, because it's hard work, you know, and you say, okay, I'm a professional. So that is another problem that we have. But the real issue is that many people start producing their own food in a very organic system. And we have people that in his jar produce vegetables with only water and land, you know? So that is how we are trying to be sustainable, you know? But because that is another challenge that we have right now. And people ask me, do you want clean energy? Yes, we want clean energy, but it's expensive and we don't have the resources. But that is our goal too, you know? And so we are trying to have the right priorities with our limited resources.
But your health care is part of the GDP. I mean, you make money off of health care worldwide, have some of the best eye care in the world. That's certainly one thing that Cuba's known for. And Michael Moore's movie, of course, was bringing people from 9/11 there to, you know, for x-rays and care, what they weren't able to get in the United States.
Yes, but remember about this that you mentioned. It's true that we have we, for example, in tourism, we receive 3 million of tourists every year. 1 million come from Canada. And we are getting some resources. But the issue is that embargo is a real issue that we say, and according to the some treaties, it's a genocide. You know, it's an economic war. You are trying to create desperation with this policy, because I'm going to put you one example about this. What is the embargo? Remember that you have this law from 1992, the Torricelli Act, that say that if a ship docks in Cuba, needs to wait 180 days to come to the United States. So imagine every time, and we are an island, we need to bring things to us by ship. If we need a ship, we need to pay more for nothing. Because people say, remember, I cannot go to the United States in 180 days. We cannot use your American dollars as a currency to buy things. And sometimes when we have American dollars, we have to change our currency to another currency, and we lost money. And there is a lot of examples. I can put you one example. 2 weeks ago, probably 3 weeks ago. There is this company here in the United States that made a business with a company in Angola. They sell some things to that company. In that company in Angola, Cuba has 20% of participation. 20% of participation. And this company in the United States was fined by the Treasury Department. A huge fine. So now nobody wants to do business with us. For example, right now, it's too difficult, or sometimes more expensive. Right now, it's possible to open an office from American banks in Cuba. But we don't have any banks in Cuba from the United States. Why? Because everybody's waiting. What is going to happen? You know, we need to change the laws first.
So the embargo has serious economic impacts. It's really left over from the Cold War. There's vested interests inside the United States to maintain it as almost punishment for Cuba, under a justification that it's a communist dictatorship, which simply isn't true.
And you have wonderful relations with communist countries, you know. You have wonderful trade relations, so there is no real excuse, you know, to have the embargo in place. The real issue is that the embargo is for another moment in history and it's not working to overthrow the government. People support the Cuban people support the government, and in that case, you see that. That is not a real policy. That is a failed policy. President Obama explained that in his last speech of the Union address. So the real issue is that the embargo is still in place. The embargo is the main obstacle for our development and also for better relations between Cuba and the United States.
Yeah, I was thinking that when you were saying that, I was thinking that even if, you know, the horrible myths about Cuba that have been perpetrated here in the United States for the last 60 years were true, we actually have normalized relationships with countries that actually do the atrocities that are claimed about Cuba. So, yeah, it is sort of ironic they're the ones we cut off conversation with. I also kind of think it's funny the high school mentality that we're just going to stop talking to. That's the way of dealing with international relations. But I was wondering, I wanted to ask you, so growing up in Cuba, shortly after this, you're born shortly after this constitutional transformation, and you come in your teen years during the fall of the Soviets and another transformation of economic policy. What is it that drove you to get into politics and international relations? Why choose this field? What was it about this? What drove you to do that?
Well, interesting question. It's always difficult to speak about myself, no, because it's not what I do. But the idea is that I am a son of a farmer. My father born in 1939, difficult moment, and he started working when he was 10 years old in 1949. So the dream of my father was that his sons can go to the university because he was unable to go. So he put all his efforts to try to say, okay, you need to be somebody, you need to go to the university. And I studied law because I love laws. You need to understand how the system works. You know, you need to understand how you can defend, how you can how to understand laws. So, and after that, I had this opportunity because of my grades. They say, okay, you can go to the diplomatic academy in Havana. You want to go? And I say, what are my opportunities there? And they say, okay, you can study a master degree in foreign relations. I say, okay, wonderful. And after that, they say, okay, if you want, you can start working in North America division, attending U.S. And I say, okay, that is what I want, because this is our main challenge, you know. And for that reason, I am here, because I really believe that we can have normal relations with respect, and it's good for both sides. And if we can see the end of the embargo, if we can put an end to that, that is going to help my people. So for that reason, I am proud to be Cuban. So many times I go to many places and people say, thanks to Cuba for all his example in education, healthcare, all the help that you have been doing in Africa and Latin America. And I say, okay, thank you very much. I took that, but I didn't I was not part of that, you know. It's my my father's generation, you know, my people. So it's I am proud to be a Cuban, to represent my people. But it's interesting how we have support, love from many people here in the United States and all around the world.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that. So you're coming into the United States, and just on this tour alone, you've had a chance to talk to many Americans. And as we kind of discussed earlier, the Americans do not know a lot about Cuba, nor the history of the United States and Cuba. So I was wondering, what sort of response are you getting from people when you tell your story about Cuba and what you've seen there growing up in Cuba? How is people responding to that here in the States, out of curiosity?
Well, I try to present all this information. Probably the professor can say what was his experience, but I try to present all of this information according to American sources or international sources, and people is completely, okay, I didn't know that. How is that possible? Why we don't have normal relations? Why I cannot travel to Cuba? So you see that what all the polls shows, that is support, is real. It's people that is there and say, why not? Why we don't have normal relation between Cuba and United States? So it's very good to see that, people comes with a lot of histories. My fathers were married in Cuba. My father have their honeymoon in Cuba, or my grandfather, depending on the generation that is there. And people say, okay, I was in Alabama, by the way. I was in Alabama, and somebody told me that Cubans learned to play baseball in Alabama. Two Cuban brothers in the 19th century were in Alabama in a school in Spring Hill College, and they learn how to play baseball, and they bring back baseball to Cuba, and now baseball is our national sport. So you see, we have a lot of history together, and the real issue is that the most important is we have the support, the real support of the people in both sides, because people know that it's possible to have normal relations and it's good for both sides. And what you mentioned about the embargo, I'm going to say, how can you explain that we have 191 countries that say to the United States, lift the embargo? It's not a bilateral issue anymore. And the other 190 countries, the 190 that support Cuba in this battle, is because they are suffering the embargo also. You know, it's difficult to do business with Cuba because of the embargo.
Who would you say are some of Cuba's most important partners for things like trade and culture?
Well, according to the numbers that I have from the World Bank, in 2013, our key trading partners are Venezuela, Canada, China, Netherlands, Brazil, and Spain. Imports and exports.
I was reading a survey that said over 56% of the Cuban Americans, people of Cuban ancestry living in the United States, now support normalization of relationships. So there isn't this hardcore, I mean, there certainly is a hardcore right wing, too many, and certainly a number of them in the Congress right now who block normalization and want to even try to reverse it. But the Council of Foreign Relations 5 years ago was making recommendations for opening trade agreements and better, because it makes economic sense for the United States. The United States would make money, it would create jobs, it would expand the capabilities of to have, you know, trading with the 11 million people in Cuba and have that kind of open access. And it certainly would improve the lives and benefit people. And imagine, I mean, that you have a million Canadians. I mean, everybody I know wants to go to Cuba now that they, oh, I can go now. You know, that's not illegal anymore. And I had a good friend who went down and came back and was fined for going there. So, you know, opening that up would be a tremendous benefit for both countries, I would think.
Oh, yes, for sure. And remember, because it's again the same question, people believe that, okay, you're going to change. No, we are doing business with all the countries in the world. So not right now, probably we have more opportunities between Cuba and United States. But you are going to open hotels there, and we have hotels from Spain, we have hotels from Germany, we have hotels from all the countries. So you're not going to be the first. Unfortunately, probably you're going to be the last, the people that goes to Cuba. But in any case, this is the most important. It's good. You don't have any excuse to say, okay, we cannot have normal relations between Cuba and United States.
We have just a few minutes left in the show, but you're speaking tonight, Friday, March 11th, at the Richmond City Council Chambers, 440 Civic Plaza in Richmond. That's a free event, and people are welcome to go by there. But for people that can't come see you, I mean, how can they support a normalization of relations with Cuba and really try to get past this Cold War mentality?
Well, I think it's very important that people know that right now we need Congress to do the real change in this. And I believe that people need to know that there are very good bills that in Congress, for example, the S-299, Freedom to Travel to Cuba. We have 47 senators that support that bill, so we are talking about 47% of the Senate, but we don't have the same support in the House. And probably what people need to know is, because sometimes people say, okay, the people in the Hill said, okay, I don't hear nothing from my district, you know? Well, if you believe that this is something that you want, well, that is something that you can do, you know? And also, try to find more information, more real information about Cuba. That is what I encourage the people to do. Try to go. Mm-hmm. My invitation is, if you don't believe me, go to Cuba. Go to Cuba and see what is the real Cuba. I want to say thanks to you for this opportunity. I really appreciate that. I want to say hello to all the people that is listening right now. Sorry for my English. Probably need to improve more, but this is a good opportunity to practice.
Well, you've been doing a very good job. Certainly, thank you. And so you're in Washington. I assume you're very active in engaging in these agendas there. And we thank you very much for your support.
Thanks to you.
And coming on our show with us. Nolan, do you have any wrap up?
I just want to say thanks for coming on the show. We appreciate having you.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Thanks to our producer and co-host, my co-host today. Anthony Fest is our engineer, and Gary Bach is our engineer. Anthony Fest is our producer. We welcome our new affiliate stations, KBWR in Billingham, Washington, and WWUH in West Hartford, Connecticut. That's 32 stations now airing the show across the U.S. Archives can be found on theprojectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Thank you very much. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of just a brother and a sister. The people together can overthrow the system.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
PUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Silent Summer. Professor Timothy Mousseau. What happens to the lives of birds, insects, and plants in the radiation zones around Chernobyl and Fukushima? You may remember a TUC Radio broadcast on the second anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. The biologist Tim Mousseau spoke at the Fukushima Symposium in New York that was organized by the physician Dr. Helen Caldicott. He concluded his talk by showing heartbreaking pictures of the birds of Chernobyl and their tumors and birth defects, and Helen Caldicott stepped up to the podium to thank him. She said, "I want to pay homage to Tim Mousseau, who with his colleagues is actually endangering his life by going into extremely high radioactive areas doing pioneering work, which is going to change the concept of radiation exposure to humans. What is happening to the animals, the insects, and the plants is going to happen to us. Tim Musso is professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. For 15 years, he and his scientific collaborator Anders Moller from the University of Paris, Sud, have done research in the most contaminated areas of Chernobyl. When Fukushima Daiichi exploded, they began fieldwork there as well. They study birds, insects, microbes, and plants at over 1,000 sites, creating the most diligent inventories of each study area and returning year after year. In the fall of 2015, Tim Musso was on his way to Fukushima to follow up. He stopped over in San Francisco and went on to Point Reyes Station. Programmers at the radio station KWMR and the Ecological Options Network had invited him to give a talk. Here's Tim Musso speaking at the Point Reyes Dance Palace on the contamination of the biosphere.
Well, so tonight, my job is to share with you some of the work that we've been doing in Chernobyl and, since about 2000 in Fukushima, more recently, two huge events. And, you know, up until a few years ago, I used to get the question all the time, why are you working in Chernobyl? Why are you bothering to study the effects of the Chernobyl disaster? And the reason people were asking me this is because everybody thought it was a unique event. It was unique to the former Soviet Union. It was unique to their management style, their engineering. It could never happen again, right? And of course, Fukushima proved that that isn't the case. And in fact, if you really want to know why we should be doing a lot more research in this area, you really only have to look very, very superficially at the history of nuclear power. And, you know, essentially, there have been about 600 reactors, plus or minus, since the beginning of time, and currently about 430 around the world in 31 countries, about 100 here in the U.S., plus or minus. We've got a bunch of new ones under construction around the world. There's four new reactors being built within 60 miles of my house in South Carolina right now. I'm not kidding you. And so, you know, nuclear is not going away. No matter what you think about nuclear power, it's here for a little while longer, at least. At least in some parts of the world. So anyway, but in this time, there have been three major accidents at the commercial nuclear power plants. That's a fairly high frequency, really, when you think about it. And there's been plenty more smaller incidents and accidents. And given that most nuclear power plants, most of them are getting older, and many of them nearing the end of their useful lifespan, we're expecting to see more accidents. In fact, there was a recent study published or promoted by MIT not too long ago that suggested that we will see another Chernobyl-scale nuclear accident by the year 2050, and we're likely to see a Three Mile Island-scale event within the next 10 years, based on a much larger data set than had been put together prior to this past year. Frequencies of accidents and engineering analyses. So we need to know more. We need to know what the consequences of accidents might be. Most of these power plants, of course, have huge stockpiles of spent fuel, and that's another issue. Another reason for understanding the effects of radioactivity in the environment is the fact that, and I didn't know this until 5 years ago, really, when I got involved in these National Academy panels, every single nuclear power plant, by design, releases literally tons of nuclear effluent every year. Of course they do. That's how we generate electricity. We're using fission, and the product of fission are these radioactive daughters that have to be dealt with. And most of them are dribbled out into the water or into the air. And, of course, as we all know, the solution to pollution is dilution, right? So as long as we can dilute the effluent below these regulatory limits that are rather arbitrarily set, then there's no problem. Well, at least for the power plant companies, they're operating legally if they can do that. But anyway, every nuclear power plant releases lots and lots of radioactivity, but for the most part, we have little knowledge of the environmental impacts of these effluents. Now, of course, we also discovered recently that most of the nuclear power plants out there have illegal releases as well, releases that, you know, that just by accident, of course. And so, we started to pay attention when it was noticed that the Vermont Yankee plant was leaking tritium off-site. And at the time, I was on a National Academy panel where they were asking, so what is the impact of leaking tritium? And we got all together for a couple of days and tried to figure this out and realized that there was insufficient scientific data to really answer the question for Congress. We really had no idea. We didn't think it was good. We didn't think it was a huge problem at this point, because for the most part, the nuclear power plants were only leaking on site. They weren't, for most of them, were not leaking it too far beyond the boundaries of the actual power plant. But in truth, we really didn't know. And that was kind of a wake-up call for a lot of people. But still, to this day, there's not a lot of research going on with respect to radiation or tritium leaks. But we are learning a little bit more every day as people put things together. There was a recent meta-analysis. This is the kind of study where you take a bunch of different studies and put them together and statistically analyze the combined data set. And when you do this for studies done in Europe primarily, epidemiological studies, what we've discovered is that if you are a pregnant woman living within 3 miles of a nuclear power plant, you have about a 100% increase, a doubling increase of the probability of your child getting leukemia. Now, that sounds terrible in one way. It certainly is terrible if your child has leukemia, if you've won the negative lottery, as it were. Luckily, childhood leukemia is a very, very rare disease, so the absolute frequencies of this disease are quite low. We need to know more. We had the 60th anniversary of the bombs being dropped on Japan, and most of what we know about the effects of radiation in the environment actually come from the studies of the atomic bomb survivors. Unfortunately, those studies didn't really start till 5, 6, 7 years after the bombs being dropped, so we missed a lot of information from that, but we have learned a lot. But we didn't actually study the effects on the environment, per se, following the atomic bombs. We have studied the effects on people, but we haven't looked at the animal populations particularly. So another reason, and especially given that there have been just an enormous... I had no idea until a few years ago. We were just going crazy back in the 50s and 60s testing atomic bombs. There were 1,193 atmospheric tests conducted around the world. I think about 400 of them by the U.S., maybe a few more than that. Total 2,700 atomic bomb tests. They released, as Ken showed earlier, enormous quantities of radioactivity that still linger at relatively high levels in some parts of the world where the testing was conducted, like the Marshall Islands, parts of the Sahara where the French were testing bombs. But again, nobody has studied the impacts on the biota in the area. Another reason for doing it. So we decided, my research team, just completely by accident. I started off as an evolutionary biologist. I'm still an evolutionary biologist. And my motivation and interest in this topic results from an interest in evolutionary biology. How are natural populations changing, adapting in response to this novel stressor? I used to work on climate change. Now I work on radiation. So we started working in Chernobyl about 15 years ago. Here's a map of the Chernobyl disaster impacts. Again, 200,000 square kilometers significantly impacted with radiation. Most people know about the stuff in Ukraine and Belarus and parts of Russia. Most people don't realize that large swaths of Scandinavia and Central Europe were also significantly contaminated. Here's a map, similar map for terrestrial Japan. Much, much smaller event from a terrestrial standpoint in terms of land mass contaminated. The Fukushima disaster is on the order of a tenth or less of the Chernobyl disaster. The Chernobyl disaster was just huge in terms of terrestrial impacts. Enormous quantities of materials released from Fukushima into the ocean. Their impacts, their biological impacts, largely unknown at this point. So why hasn't there been more investment in basic research associated with these kinds of events? I would argue that in part it's because the attitudes that have been presented by agencies, intergovernmental agencies in charge of promoting the peaceful use of atomic energy, right? For instance, the IAEA, who suggested in their report from 10 years ago that we had nothing to worry about. In fact, you've probably seen the TV shows that have suggested that the Chernobyl zone is thriving, the animals are doing great because there's a fence and there's no people, and so then the effects of people are bigger than the effects of radiation. But there were no data presented to support that. There were no scientific studies to support that. This report from the International Atomic Energy Agency from the Director General just came out this week relating to Fukushima, and it's largely based on the UNSCAR report that came out last year. It's a complete whitewash. They have not reviewed the literature, is what I'm saying. They have not commissioned any scientific research. They have not paid attention to the scientific research that has been generated in the last 10 years from Chernobyl and the last 4 years from Fukushima. No rigorous empirical scientific data. So anyway, a few years ago in 2000, just out of casual curiosity, a colleague of mine, Anders Mahler, who is a very prominent biologist, we decided to work together on this project, visit Chernobyl, and kind of as a sideline, start looking at some of the birds in Chernobyl and see what was going on with them. We thought it would be a novel, new, creative approach to studying evolutionary processes. And, of course, that's been very interesting. We started working together there in July of 2011, so a few months after the disaster in Fukushima. We're mostly interested in, as the physicists say, we're the bird and bunny guys. You know, we're interested in birds and bunnies, and it's kind of derogatory, I know, but it is true. We've been interested in basically the biological endpoints, and we've also been interested in the children, more or less. Made a whole bunch of visits to Chernobyl and Fukushima over the years, and published. We're over 80 papers now. And one thing I did want to mention is that, you know, we consider ourselves to be independent scientists. We're not anti-nuclear activists at all. We're simply scientists looking to find new things to see. The work that we do is driven by simple hypotheses and questions, and you know, very, very simple logic, straightforward logic is what governs what we do. The first question is simply, are the doses that we see in these areas high enough to cause genetic damage, mutations to the organisms? Pretty simple. If we don't see any evidence of genetic damage, then we don't have to look any further. We don't need to be concerned, right? But if we do see genetic damage, that's not enough by itself. Certainly a good hint, but it's not enough. And so the next question is, are there consequences to the shape and size, performance of the organisms as a result of the genetic damage? Are there fitness consequences? Is there any evidence of adaptation? Are there effects leading to population changes in terms of abundances and diversity? And finally, are there ecosystem functioning consequences to that? And that's been the driving force of what we're doing. So what have we found? And I don't have enough time to really go into any detail. I'm going to zip through, hit the highlights. If any of you are interested, our website has links to most of our papers. I encourage you to go there. And, of course, you're welcome to ask me any questions you'd like. Right, first thing, start with the mutation stuff, the genetic damage stuff. So we've done all sorts of studies looking for genetic damage in a whole bunch of different ways and a whole bunch of different critters, and other people have as well. This year we published a paper which basically was a meta-analysis. It's one of these analyses of analyses, basically where we take data from all different sources, put it together and analyze it in a combined data set. Gives us a lot more power to look at patterns. And the basic finding was that radiation from Chernobyl causes mutations. Big surprise. It was overwhelming. The size of the effect due to Chernobyl radiation was extremely large. And it's no big surprise. Radiation causes genetic damage in Chernobyl. But what are the consequences? Does it matter? Maybe, you know, we all have mutations. We all accumulate mutations with every cell division. And in fact, our cells are working as hard as they can to repair the genetic damage that occurs as a normal part of physiology. One of my friend's colleagues told me that with every cell division, there are 50 breaks in the chromosomes that have to be repaired. So radiation is just adding to that. But so maybe there aren't any visible consequences of the added mutational load. Well, there are. Lots and lots.
You're listening to Professor Timothy Mousseau. If you would like to get the background information for his research, you can find his website under Faculty at the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina. Here's a summary of the slides that he showed. Mousseau and Mahler found many cases of tumors, abnormalities, aberrations, and close dose-response relationships. He remembered first seeing birds with white patches of feathers in Chernobyl and now in Fukushima. He and his colleagues developed a way of taking sperm from birds without hurting them and discovered that the count was low or there was no sperm at all. Since we know from atomic bomb victims that the cells in the lens of the eyes are susceptible to ionizing radiation, they began looking for similar effects in the birds of Chernobyl and found a high percentage of cataracts. When they looked at rodents, they found the same results. In that context, they found that females are more susceptible to radiation, and they are still unsure why that is. Mousseau and Mahler looked at females of a species more closely, and they discovered a phenomenon in birds that is known for almost 100 years in women, microencephaly. Tim Mousseau.
Another thing that was first noticed in women, pregnant women who were treated with radium therapy and x-ray therapy in the 20s, when they started using x-rays and radium to treat cancers, but some of the women were pregnant, and so they actually discovered first that these children of these women were much more likely to show microencephaly, smaller brains, and developmental problems, also discovered in the atomic bomb survivors. So we started looking at the birds, and sure enough, birds from the more radioactive area had about 5% smaller brains. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it turns out that a bird with a 5% smaller brain has about a 50% lower chance of surviving from 1 year to the next, again suggesting that there are cognitive consequences of this this effect. Again, not particularly surprising given what we've known of radiation effects from the medical literature, but again, surprising that we hadn't done any of this kind of research in Chernobyl. The rodents show the same kind of effect in both Chernobyl and in Fukushima. Smaller brains in the more radioactive areas. Essentially, everything we look at, sometimes the insects are a fun tool to use because they're easy to catch and they often have interesting patterns on their bodies. Well, we were walking around Pripyat. This is this town just outside of near the reactor that was built to house the engineers at Chernobyl. Walking through Pripyat one day and. Actually, we were collecting flowers for pollen, and my colleague, Anders, looked down on the ground, and there was one of these firebugs. And he pulls it up, and he goes, "Tim, look, this one's missing an eye." And sure enough. And so we started collecting them. And in that one day, we collected a whole bunch. I've put a few postcards out in the lobby if any of you want this picture. And, of course, we have it on the website if you want it. I thought it was just remarkable how easy it was to capture the impact of radiation on development using this kind of a model. We also started seeing strange growth forms in the trees. These are pine trees from Chernobyl. Again, very, very strange growth forms, strange color changes. If any of you familiar with the Yablokov book on Chernobyl may recognize this from the cover. It's one of my photos, again, showing changes in the color and quality of the wood. Again, major impacts. Just this week, a paper published out of Japan showing similar consequences for the fir trees in around Fukushima in response to the radiation. So, bottom line, we know there's lots of mutations, lots of genetic effects. We know there are tons of phenotypic consequences, from very, very obvious to much more subtle, but absolutely no question consequences, developmental consequences of this added mutational load. But does it matter? Does it really matter in terms of ecology? Does it matter in terms of the abundance and biodiversity of the organisms that are there? And that really has been, this has really been the main focus of a lot of our work. And we've taken kind of an unusual approach that hasn't really been done before. What we decided to do, because we don't know, we didn't know exactly how many critters were there before these disasters, right? You never have baseline data for these disasters. By definition, they're unpredictable. And so you have to come up with clever ways to generate predictions about what was there before so that you can compare that to what you see now. And so the way we've gotten at this is to do what I call massively replicated biotic inventories, where we go to many, many places, count all the critters we see at that given location, and put that into a giant statistical model. In Chernobyl, we've gone to Ukraine and Belarus and looked at about 400 different locations a few times. In Fukushima, we've gone to 400 locations for 4 years now and basically surveyed the range of critters at a range of radioactive contamination levels. And again, we put it into this kind of a model where we have our inventories, we have our measures of everything else that's important to the distribution and abundance of an organism, not just radiation. So, you know, bird distribution is determined by a lot of things, not just one thing. So if you're going to ask the question about radiation, you have to know the other factors that are also influencing their distribution. And then you have to have radiation measurements and GIS and some multivariate statistics. And using that, you can predict what should be in a given place in the absence of radiation. And this is what we've done, published a bunch of papers on it, including 3 papers on Fukushima birds just this spring. In Chernobyl, basically, abundances during the time period that we looked at it 10 years ago, about one-third as many birds as there should be in the more highly contaminated areas, about half as many species. Fukushima, that's the one everybody's interested in. After 4 years of repeated sampling, this is what we find. Huge impacts, dramatically fewer birds in the areas of high radiation, many dramatically fewer species of birds as well. What I wanted to do was to show you what it sounds like. This is an area that's relatively normal. This is an area up the road, and this is not a scientific analysis, obviously. 15 miles up the road, very high radiation level in Fukushima. Since it was July, and call this a silent summer effect, it's really a dead zone. There are no butterflies, no birds, very few. And it's very, very clearly the result of the radioactive contaminants. So what does this all mean? Contrary to those important reports by government agencies, there's clearly an abundance of information. It's not just our data that's showing that there are consequences of the levels of contamination that we see in Fukushima and Chernobyl. In other words, injuries to individuals, population, species, and even ecosystem functioning. I didn't have time to talk about today, but trust me. Long list of major findings, mutations, phenotypic effects, reproductive effects, effects on longevity, everything that you would predict that radiation might do, we can see in Chernobyl and Fukushima. So what are we going to do about it? We're hoping that we can mount a serious scientific effort to document a range of biological consequences, that we can document the range of relationships with different dose rates for these different organisms. We found tremendous variability among individuals and species in the responses. And some individuals, some species have actually shown adaptive responses, positive responses, evolved adaptive responses. We need to know a lot more about what the constraints are. But this effort, needs to be conducted by independent scientists, scientists at universities or at research institutions that are not directly part of any governmental agency or any regulatory body. And why does it matter to you? You recognize this? Look at that. It's right there, right on the water. I hear there are 20 fault zones surrounding it. And then, of course, the other reason is it's coming. It is coming. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
And what Professor Timothy Mousseau was showing was the image of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant in California, sitting at the ocean in the crosshairs of 20 earthquake faults. That was an update of the courageous and solitary work of Timothy Mousseau and his colleague Anders Moller. Mousseau is professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. Moller teaches at the University Paris Sud in France. You can find a link to their website at tucradio.org. Tim Mousseau spoke on September 2, 2015, at Point Reyes Station in California. Many thanks to Bing Gong and Mary Beth Brangen for letting me use their recording. The full audio file is on postcarbon.podomatic.com. That's postcarbon.podomatic.com. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Increasingly, climate change is a very important component in how military planners see the future, and they see what they are doing as militarily managing a planet that is slipping into profound crisis.
That's the voice of Dr. Christian Parenti. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Parenti about his new book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Wars, and the New Geography of Violence. Christian talks about relationships between militarism, climate change, and neoliberalism coming together for the perfect storm. So stay tuned.
Someone who is
asking us to not just look at society through a reflective lens and take some responsibility for what is going on. It's my next guest, Christian Parenti. His latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
What is the Tropic of Chaos?
Well, the Tropic of Chaos is basically the global south. You know, I'm referring to the space between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, the equatorial regions of the planet. But it's not so much a fixed place as it is, you know, the political space created by the world system, the world order. And what the book is about the way that climate change is already provoking and driving violence. And it is doing that primarily in the global south by interacting with two pre-existing crises, the legacy of Cold War militarism and the legacy of neoliberal economic restructuring. So Cold War militarism has littered the global south with cheap weapons and populations traumatized by war, populations of primarily men trained in war, and when the ideological underpinnings of the conflict of the Cold War evaporated, a lot of the technologies and patterns and habits and relationships and systems that were those proxy wars did not evaporate, and the violence continues now as organized crime or as ethnic violence or as religious violence. It's no longer this great conflict between capitalism and socialism. So that's like the legacy of the Cold War, which is profoundly destabilizing for the South, global South. And then the legacy of neoliberalism is, you know, and neoliberalism being the policy of radical free market economic restructuring promulgated by the Bretton Woods institutions of the World Bank and the IMF since the late 70s, early 80s, has required that states facing debt, which we could talk about why the debt crisis happened, states facing debt have to impose austerity, which is to say, in a nutshell, the state has to reduce its capacity to plan and intervene in the economy. And this is the economic theory of neoliberalism rooted in the work of Hayek and Friedman. And that has systematically led to the dismantling of all manner of progressive and sort of semi-socialist policies throughout the global south. And, you know, I'm talking about within the capitalist world. And so there's a lot of, you know, mixed economic experimentation in the global south from the end of World War II up into the 1980s. And then all of that is just systematically hammered by neoliberalism. So that has led to societies where the state lacks capacity, it can't plan, it lacks legitimacy, it's infused with corruption, and societies marked by tremendous inequality, increases in absolute poverty, and as, the, you know, awash in weapons, et cetera, due to the Cold War. And then now into this comes climate change, expressing itself as extreme weather events like droughts punctuated by flooding. I mean, generally, as the planet warms up, the atmosphere holds more energy and water. There's more evaporation. So there's, in a lot of places, actually an increase in overall precipitation, but it comes in such sudden shocks that the actual experience economically and socially and ecologically on the ground is one of drought. So like in Kenya, for example, where I opened the book, Kenya has actually seen an increase in precipitation over the last 30 years, but it is suffering a major drought because the rain comes all at once at the wrong time as floods that wash away the crops, so it doesn't actually help deal with the problem of creating food and livelihoods for people. So, you know, that combination of the pre-existing crisis of neoliberalism, the legacy of the Cold War, and the onset of anthropogenic climate change, I call that combination the catastrophic convergence. And it plays out differently in different places. And so the book is a tour across the equatorial latitudes of the planet, looking at the specific histories of places and specific conflicts. So the conflict, the sort of interlocking set of conflicts that are the conflict system of the Horn of Africa, the kind of the conflict system of Central Asia, which links the Indian and Pakistani conflicts to the occupation and insurgency in Iraq, and then they look at Latin America and the role of migration from the countryside into the favelas of Rio, and how there's an attenuated but very real climatological link to the drug violence there, and similarly to the drug violence in Mexico, which is met, you know, all of this gathering crisis in the global south is met in the global north by increasingly bellicose plans for open-ended counterinsurgency and counterterrorism on a global scale. And this is expressed in the planning documents of the United States Armed Forces and other European forces as well. And this is not all classified. I mean, you can actually find these reports online where they discuss how climate change will be leading to increased civil war, ethnic conflict, religious warfare, social breakdown, and how the response of the militaries of the developed world is going to have to be a program of constant counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and, you know, sort of humanitarian interventionism. And so you see that in the global north, the expression of climate violence is increased border militarization and this kind of war on terror, humanitarian intervention, kind of matrix of interventions, the forward deployment of drones and special forces, the embedding of advisory teams, you know, and the outright occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan to some extent fit to this kind of whole posture that is developing. And Libya was an example of this kind of, you know, this system of warfare, which is not particularly new, you know, using proxy, local proxies on the ground, supporting them with air and advisors and, you know, limited special forces and then contractors to help with the kind of logistics, et cetera. So this is increasingly the posture of militaries in the West, and it is, if you dig into it, though each and every conflict is not described as climate war, if you look into the kind of central big-picture planning documents, increasingly climate change is a very important component in how military planners see the future, and they see what they are doing as militarily managing a planet that is slipping into profound crisis.
In relation to the mass militarization that we see today and the linkages that many of our governments are making in terms of keeping ourselves safe, and with the war in Iraq, we saw a precedent being made in that no longer did a country have to be attacked in order to declare war on another. We could simply go in there and you know, attack another country. This war on terror has been not only legitimized by the media, but almost naturalized as the right of imperial states to bring liberating democracy to, you know, backward countries in the global south.
What's happened to the capitalist order since World War II is essentially that the golden era of capitalism, the age of high rates of growth, high rates of profitability, all of which could sustain high rates of taxation and increasing wages while there's still profitable, you know, very high after-tax profits for corporations. That whole golden era from the 50s through the 60s was predicated on the recovery, the rebuilding of Europe and Asia surrounding Japan, and that the model, the sort of Keynesian model of industrialization, attempted to sort of build internal markets and internal capacities and make capitalism prosperous and include the working classes in a way to fend off the threat of socialism. So that model works because it fits into the Cold War project of the West, and it achieves high rates of growth and profitability while also including elements of the working class. That then begins to break down in the 1970s because the world has finally recovered economically from World War II, and there's a classic crisis of overproduction or overaccumulation. There's just too much stuff and not enough effective demand, though there are people who still need things like basic sanitation and education and shoes. The classes of people who can afford refrigerators and blue jeans generally by the late 60s already have them, and the world economy begins to slow down, and profit rights go into crisis in the kind of core, mature, older economies like the U.S. and the U.K., and you get a shift in planning elites away from Keynesian demand management towards neoliberal austerity, which is based on cutting taxes, on capital, increasing taxes on workers, slashing wages, both direct wages and the social wage in terms of health and educational benefits that people get, smashing union power, and smashing the public sector to pieces. And so that's been the project that begins with Reagan and Thatcher in the West and then emanates out through the World Bank and IMF globally. And it, of course, creates tremendous pushback, sometimes organized and successful and politicized, and sometimes it just creates crisis and violence and desperation. And so the response is from the kind of core economies and core policy establishments of world capitalism is increased repression. You have to manage these contradictions. I mean, the choice, as Machiavelli says, it's like the prince can either treat men well or crush them. And so, you know, if the system of managing a class inequality and a capitalist economy isn't going to be based on sort of ameliorative welfare measures, then the choice for elites is ever greater levels of violence, surveillance, and repression. And so that kind of violence is core to the neoliberal project. I mean, you cannot have the massive deindustrialization of economies, the massive pauperization of previously, stable working classes, and the massive upward redistribution of wealth and the disruption and denigration of public services without dislocation, either active, organized political resistance or rising criminality and desperation. And so in either case, the response is more cops, more surveillance, more repression, wars such as, the war in Libya or various wars that maybe at first glance don't seem to be about that economic order, but are fundamentally about, reestablishing the dominance of the U.S.-led kind of coalition of wealthy nations.
Talk a little bit about the linkage between the already felt climate change impact on local economies, particularly in India, Africa, and this increased ownership and displacement by monopoly companies, who are pushing the farmers away from subsistence farming, for commodified crops.
The clearest example of that, as you alluded to in your question, is in India, where in the book Tropic Chaos, I went to Andhra Pradesh in southern India to look at the link between the Naxalite Maoist guerrilla war movement and climate change. And so what one sees is that there's this drought, and the guerrillas follow the drought. And what they are reacting to is not just the drought, but basically the farmers, in the face of drought, go into debt because they can't turn to the state for assistance, because neoliberalism since 1991 has really stripped the Indian state of its capacities to help farmers. So they turn to the private money lenders to get some money to try and cope with the loss of crops due to drought and replant in hopes that the next year will be better, or to dig a well to start, irrigating their crops to make up for the diminishment of the winter rains. And so the money lenders will only lend money for planting cotton. They won't lend money if the farmer is going to plant food crops. And the reason for that is that in an emergency, a farmer could steal his collateral, that is to say, eat the crop. And when an indebted farmer plants cotton, they have no choice but to sell it. Cotton is totally useless to the farmer. And so that ensures the moneylender will get their cash. And so you get, the deeper the drought goes, then the deeper in debt the farmers go. The more in debt they are, the more cotton there is. The more cotton that's planted, the lower the prices on cotton. The lower the prices go, the more the whole cycle continues. And the cotton that's being used is genetically modified cotton, Monsanto's GMO, which at first is, like the first 3 or 4 years, is tremendously productive. You get much higher yields, but it strips the soil of all nutrients. And so it then requires actually increased inputs. So they have to borrow even more money to provide artificial fertilizer for the cotton and pesticides. And so they sink deeper and deeper into debt. And the result is that farmers are killing themselves 2,000 farmers in Andhra Pradesh have killed themselves. Across India, 200,000 farmers have killed themselves due to their debts. But other farmers, you know, reaching that point of desperation, decide that they're going to kill their oppressors, and they join the Naxalites, and they kill the moneylenders, and they fight the police when the police come to investigate and you know, round up the agitators. And so you have this 40-year-old civil war in India that for most of the last 40 years was pretty contained in West Bengal, and now it's, over the last 15 years, spread down the eastern side of India because of this drought, and that's the kind of dynamic that drives it. And, I mean, there's different areas have specific stories. So, like, in Chhattisgarh, the issue is less drought. It's more about mining. It's not about agricultural immiseration. It's about resisting this massive mining projects. So there's a specific articulation of things in specific regions, but a lot of it is driven by drought and this drought debt, cotton, violence kind of connection.
You know, many ways, a lot of people in Canada would say, well, that's explainable because, you know, those countries don't have a nice democracy like we do in Canada or the U.S. And, you know, they have this despot government, you know, and that seems to be the common explanation. What would you say to them?
Well, there is some truth to that. I mean, democratic government is better than despotic government. I mean, India actually has a democracy. And that democracy has, to some extent, at times, put checks on private interest. And actually, you know, the Congress-led coalition, it has a pretty robust work program, sort of like emergency work program to deal with rural poverty. But the issue is, you know, within democracies is the one that your listeners, I'm sure, are well aware of, and you probably talk about all the time, of, like, you know, money in politics and versus people being organized. And so democratic government can be very effective for checking corporate power when people are organized, but it can also be very susceptible to the influence of money. And
I'm particularly ambivalent about that response because I think that while we do proclaim to have very democratic governments, we do have in Canada legislation that it's now creating same sentences for all, you know, crimes, and that means
increasing incarceration. You have to look at the consent around that, though. You know, that those right wing policies have massive consent. That's part of why you have a right wing government here in Canada, is because there are a lot of Canadians who like that. They like Stephen Harper, and so that then is the question. The question is, why do Canadians like Stephen Harper? You know, it's one thing to condemn these right wingers. It's another thing to understand, well, why do the working class in the United States and all these places, why do they like these guys? What makes that tick? And then you get into stuff about how people have been conditioned to not think about class questions, and they think about, you know, race and, you know, whatever the various tropes and stories are that these, you know, right-wing populists use to mobilize consent around these repressive projects.
I think it's both. I think that it's also the fact that we have a political system that is not designed to deliver the populist vote. In the U.S., you have two choices, conservative or Democrats. They're both on the same team. In Canada, we have the liberals and the conservatives who are also both ultra-right wing. And, you know, we have the NDP who plays a leftist center's policy. So we really don't have a political system that can deliver a populist vote. That's, I think, one of the problems. However, I do think one is better than the other. But I think that that kind of lost sense of agency has led to policies like the SB 1070 bill, you know, in Arizona, being propagated as something that is populist when it's not. The majority of the populations in the U.S., I would argue, would reject that. Yet, those are policies that are being put in place because we don't see our laws, our governments, as part of social construction, as we being parts of that agentic force.
Well, it's also because people are just not organized. You know, I mean, the left is not very organized in the United States. It's more organized in Canada. And when the left finally got organized, they actually pushed back quite effectively against SB 1070 in Arizona and defenestrated the main champion of that. They recalled and got rid of one of the primary right-wing politicians who championed that. But I think there's, you know, this is not an area of expertise of mine, but, I mean, now you're getting into the issue of social movements. I mean, that's what the core issue is. I mean, yes, okay, we have a democracies, parliamentary democracies that have lots of flaws. They allow money, all of these advantages, but they do also allow the left to use its you know, all of these civil rights to mobilize and pressure. And to the extent that there has been a humanized form of capitalism developed in the West, it is because of those kinds of class struggles, that labor primarily, you know, the history is primarily of working class people organizing through trade unions and other kinds of movements and political parties to press their demands, and using extra parliamentary tactics like, you know, sit-in strikes, sit-down strikes, and all of this stuff, but then also mobilizing enough pressure so that there is an element of the political class that wants to have stuff like, you know, public health insurance, as you have in Canada, that sort of stuff. So one of the issues with right-wing democratic politics has to do with the left not being capable of organizing. In the United States, the left is pathetically, you know, unorganized. And at the heart of it, I think, is the trade union movement, which, to my mind, is absolutely essential to any revival of the left and is currently in a very, very bad way and doesn't have much political imagination and basically just out of desperation shovels most of it, or maybe not most, but a very large amount of money into buying, you know, goodwill with the Democratic Party, and not enough in resources into organizing new sectors of the economy, organizing unemployed people, thinking creatively about having a long-term plan to move the whole agenda back, you know, as far as possible to the left, to kind of have more increased popular control over the economy.
I love your book in that it brings together the efforts of those who are anti-war movements and those that, want to create changes to, you know, improve the environment. What gives you hope that we can accomplish this?
Well, the one thing that gives me hope is the fact that there is plenty of money. It's not like we don't have the resources, and it's not like we don't have the technology, you know. We could get off fossil fuels very quickly. We have, you know, society has invented wind power and invented, you know, increasingly inexpensive solar voltaic technology. So those things exist. It would be horrible if we, like, didn't have those kinds of technologies. We have them. We also have enormous, enormous amounts of money. I mean, the U.S. military budget is so huge. I mean, so much could be done with that money. Corporate America is also sitting on enormous amounts of uninvested cash. And I'm not talking about the profits that are paid or the bonuses. This is just money for operation that is not being invested. With political, all those money and technology could be put in the right direction. So it becomes a political problem, and that's not insurmountable. That's something we can deal with.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. We've come to the end of our show. I want to give you an opportunity to tell our audience how they can access your book.
They can go to their local bookstore. They can go online.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And now for a brief update on the climate talks that are happening in Durban, South Africa, courtesy of Rabble.ca, which is doing a lot of good work covering this conference. So I'll bring that to you now.
You will not believe what happened at COP17 this week. Globally, there have been discussions about whether the World Bank will govern the climate fund. The implications of this mean whether or not developing countries will be further indebted because the World Bank tends to give out loans rather than grants. And it's likely that we're not going to have a global agreement until 2020, and there has been no text yet. It's still in the making. In terms of Canada, it has sweeped the awards for the worst country at the climate negotiations every day. It has abandoned Kyoto, which is the only legally binding agreement that we have. It has been condemned by countries such as Brazil and China. And Canada has said that developed countries should not have to do more than developing to reduce its emissions, and that developing nations should not use the guilt card. By doing this, Canada is failing to pay for the mess that it has caused and has a responsibility to repay developing nations. Finally, Canada has been lobbying so that developing countries pull out of Kyoto. So, overall this week, Canada has put polluters over people.
As Canadians and citizens of the world, we should feel extremely disappointed in Canada's environmental record. The Liberal government brought us in to the Kyoto Protocol, which was a good thing, but emissions drastically increased under the Liberal watch. And now, as reported by Environmental News Service, Canada's Environmental Minister Kent said that the Kyoto Protocol is the past, but he would not publicly confirm that Ottawa intends to formally withdraw from the accord that binds 36 developed countries and the European Union to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. Kent told a news conference in Ottawa that he was neither confirming nor denying that Ottawa will pull out of its Kyoto commitments. As we heard in the interview with Christian Parente, this is not an issue of finance nor technology. It's a political problem. And if we don't get organized on the left, and if we don't build strong social movements, our governments, Canada and elsewhere, can continue to stall on climate action with these kinds of announcements. So we know what we have to do. Let's get busy doing it. We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.